Welcome to exclusive coverage of the National Thoroughbred Racing Hall of Fame Induction Ceremony on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by the Maryland Horse Breeders Association.
Ben's cat did it. Long live the king, King Leatherberry.
Now Lava Man takes charge at the top of the stretch, and he could very well be gone in the Gold Cup. Lava Man is suddenly four lengths in front, and forget about it. He is going to open up and run away.
It's going to be River Keen and Chris Antley to win it. Three lengths on the line.
They can't beat the Heat. Extra Heat. She wins it by 2.5 in 1:22.3.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Humphrey S. Finney Sales Pavilion in Saratoga Springs, New York, located just across the street from the oldest racetrack and sporting venue in the United States, Saratoga. And it's appropriate that Horse Racing's Hall of Fame would be situated here, surrounded by the history and the lore of this great sport. I'm Mike Penna, alongside retired top trainer Jude Feld here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, and happy to have you joining us on this very special day in Saratoga. JT Thoroughbred Racing's Hall of Fame class was first enshrined in 1955, the very first class. Since that day, its members have exemplified the greatest that this grand old sport has to offer, and today, no exception.
Yeah, no, it's a great field this year. Nice horses, fantastic people, and really looking forward to this. It's one of the most enjoyable experiences for me during the course of the year, the Hall of Fame inductions. I really enjoy seeing all the Hall of Famers that are still living that come to visit and to honor the new inductees, and it's just a great event, open to the public, and a lot of fun. Good crowd here already.
Yeah, great crowd. The ceremony beginning at 10:30 Eastern time, so we will take you right up until that point. Master of Ceremonies Tom Durkin, former race caller here with the New York Racing Association, will welcome everybody at 10:30. We'll have an address from the president of the National Museum of Racing and Hall of Fame, Gretchen Jackson, and then we'll introduce some of the past Hall of Famers that are in attendance, and so many. We've seen Angel Cordero Jr., Pat Day, Braulio Baeza Jr. making an appearance here for the very first time today.
Braulio Baeza Sr., I think.
Yes. Junior is the steward across the street.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
senior, right. That's right.
Senior. And looking forward to seeing him. He was one of my favorite riders when he rode, and he's just a very classy man. So looking forward to seeing Braulio. Haven't seen him in a while.
We need to thank Brian Boyer here at the Hall of Fame for this setup as well. And I know you can't see us because we're on radio, but we are looking directly at the podium. It could not be a better vantage point here, Jude. If the people have never been to the Fasig Tipton Sales Pavilion, of course, this is where they're going to auction off horses in the Saratoga sale Monday and Tuesday evening. You're going to hear that coverage with us beginning at 7 o'clock each night. But it has a host of seats in the lower arena and then an upper balcony area, which is lined with seats. And we are positioned right in the middle of that upper balcony, looking directly at the podium. Couldn't be a better vantage point.
Oh, yeah. No, we have the best seat in the house, as per usual, most racetracks. Sometimes feel a little guilty about that, but we do enjoy it, and it's great to be here. They always do a nice job at this event.
Well, in terms of what we're going to see throughout the morning, the Hall of Fame will welcome four new members here today. Jockey Chris Antley, trainer King Leatherberry, and racehorses Lava Man and Extra Heat. So it's a distinguished class. Of course, Chris Antley no longer with us. King Leatherberry is indeed with us, and he has accomplished so much. And I know many people looking forward to his speech here this evening. He is a highly charismatic individual, and the 82-year-old native of Baltimore gracing Saratoga with his presence here this morning.
Yeah, he's a cool guy and a wonderful guy to talk to. Fantastic interview. And we love talking to King Leatherberry. A lot of people lobbied for a few years to get him into the Hall of Fame. It was kind of an oversight by the committee, but he finally got in this year, and I'm so happy for him that he's here to enjoy it and going to have a really super day.
Well, how about this? He saddled his very first winner at Sunshine Park back in 1959. Now, Sunshine Park, if you're not familiar with that venue, is now known as Tampa Bay Downs. He currently ranks fourth all-time in career wins with 6,457. King Leatherberry has won 52 training titles in Maryland, 26 at Pimlico and Laurel, and four at Delaware Park, with career purse earnings of more than $62 million. You think this guy deserves to be in the Hall of Fame? Or what?
You would think so. I thought he deserved to be in the Hall of Fame several years ago, actually. The guy was such a Maryland stalwart for many years and won so many races, such a talented trainer, and he certainly deserves to be here.
Jockey Chris Antley, of course, born in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, grew up in South Carolina. He won 3,480 races, had purse earnings of more than $92 million in his career that spanned from 1983 until his death in 2000 at the age of 34. Left us far too soon, but tonight, or this morning, we will celebrate his life and his career.
Yeah, he was a really nice guy, fun to be around. I didn't get to spend a lot of time with Chris, but the time I did spend with him, I enjoyed his company. He was a very good fellow, and he is missed by the racing public and owners and trainers for sure, especially those who rode him on a regular basis.
How about the two racehorses we welcome here today with Lava Man and Extra Heat? I mean, Lava Man may be the greatest claim in the history of thoroughbred racing, right?
Yeah, no question about it. And very, very excited to see him go in. He was a super talented horse. And, of course, my old employee, Doug O'Neill, trained him, did such a great job with him. Very exciting for California racing to have Lava Man go into the Hall of Fame.
Lava Man won 7 Grade 1 races, more than any other Calbred in history. He posted a career record of 17 wins, 8 seconds and 5 thirds from 47 lifetime starts. He had earnings of $5.2 million. And among California-bred horses, only Hall of Famers, Tisnow and Best Pal. And, of course, 2014 Horse of the Year California Chrome have higher career earnings.
Yeah,
distinguished company.
Yeah, pretty good crew, and he did it the hard way. You know, a lot of his earnings, came later on in his life when he became such a good horse. But he was a hard knocking horse, and he's continued on his career as a pony, and just a very cool horse to be around.
Well, one thing that always strikes me when I think about Lava Man is the fact that he won 3 consecutive editions of the Hollywood Gold Cup from 2005. To 2007, and we're going to take a look back at that 2007 running by Lava Man.
And the stage is set as Lava Man has taken over the lead. He'll have to deal with Mullingau, who's under the whip and 2 lengths from the front. AT Excellent is back to third. AT Excellent is battling back inside of Lava Man. Lava Man is only ahead in front. AT Excellent battles on bravely and maybe even retakes the lead. Lava Man to the outside. AT Excellent at the rail. Big boost on a length and a half from the front. Lava Man, AT Excellent, big boost on Lava Man. Yes! There's the original Rags to Riches. Lava Man did it again by a nose. AP Excellent and Big Booster.
And elated Vic Stauffer with the call of the Hollywood Gold Cup in 2007.
Yeah, he probably needed a hernia surgery after that call. That was incredible. That was kind of Vic's tagline, you know, Lava Man, yes. And we know he did that for your horse.
Yeah, right? Rush Rush.
Yes.
Rush Rush, not in the Hall of Fame, though.
Not, no. Could have been if he lasted a little longer. He was a pretty good horse, but very, very exciting. And Vic, obviously, into that race and into the history of the whole thing.
Yeah, and of course, that third consecutive Hollywood Gold Cup matched only Hall of Famer Native Diver and his accomplishment when he pulled it off from 1965 to 1967. Of course, Lava Man also won back-to-back runnings of the Santa Anita Handicap from 2006 and 2007. How about Extra Heat? Owned by Ken Taylor and John Salzman Sr., trained by John Salzman Sr. Here is the Eclipse Award winner for champion 3-year-old filly in 2001. Extra Heat compiled a career record of 26 wins. That's right, 26 wins, 5 seconds, 2 thirds from 35 starts. She had earnings of more than $2.3 million.
Yeah, she was a freak. She really could run, and it was always a pleasure to watch her. Tremendous speed and very, very, very nice filly.
She won a total of 25 stakes races. 11 of those were graded events, including this performance.
Cope with this Coyote. His second. Down on the inside is Chasm, and then it's Aaron Moore, and the half mile was run in 46 seconds. And they're coming for the quarter pole. Extra Heat, the big favorite, is in front now by 2.5 lengths. Aaron Moore on the outside, Chasm at the rail. Cope with this Coyote in between horses. Extra Heat doing it very easily here. It's Extra Heat by 3 lengths. Aaron Moore is second, a 16th to the finish. Extra Heat now feels the whip from jockey Rick Wilson, but she's clear of Aaron Moore, and Extra Heat wins here by 2 lengths. Aaron Moore second.
John Embriel with the call of the 2001 Cicada Stakes, and couldn't have been more impressive in winning that day either.
Yeah, she just, would run horses off their feet. I mean, very talented filly, very consistent, and John Salzman did such an excellent job keeping her in top form for such a long time.
Well, the Hall of Fame members, or the inductees, are voted on by 180 members on the panel, the voting committee, which is comprised of writers, broadcasters, industry officials, and historians. Now, the voters had to choose from a final list of 10, and they could mix and match horses and people in any combination. There were 6 others, obviously, that did not get in to this year's Hall of Fame. Jockeys Victor Espinoza, Corey Nakatani, and Craig Perrett were among them. And JT, Victor Espinoza, I would imagine after what he did this year with the Triple Crown on American Pharoah, probably a shoe-in, probably 1-9 to get in next year.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, he's done it all now, so no reason to keep him out. And the other guys were the candidates as well, but Victor's in rarefied air right now.
The horses that did not make it in, there were 2 of them, including your wife's all-time favorite horse, Black Tie Affair, did not make it this year. Kona Gold also on the outside looking in.
Yeah, Black Tie Affair, awesome horse, and Kona Gold, trained by Bruce Headley, a fantastic sprinter, very consistent horse, and those two also richly deserve to be here, but they'll have to wait another year.
Yeah, if you're wondering about the one trainer that did not get in, that is trainer David Whiteley not getting enough votes to make it in this year.
Yeah, there's another guy that had a fantastic career, was so good for thoroughbred racing, and hopefully he'll make it in soon.
All right, we're edging closer to the beginning of this year's Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Again, it begins at 10:30 Eastern. You're going to hear all of it right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, so stay with us. We'll get to a break. We're back with more live from Saratoga, and all of our coverage today presented by our friends at the Maryland Horse Breeders Association.
Celebrating 10 years of Eclipse award-winning coverage. Thank you for making HRRN your home for a decade of memories.
Every morning in Maryland, a new day dawns on more than 16,000 horse farms. From the mountains to the ocean and all along the Chesapeake Bay, new life surges from paddock to field to track, energizing the O-line state's grandest sport. Maryland, we grow horses.
To learn more about racing and breeding in Maryland, visit MarylandThoroughbred.com.
HRRN's Saturdays at Saratoga series continues tomorrow with the Whitney and the Test Stakes. Tune in beginning at 5 p.m. Eastern for live stakes racing from the Spa.
And it's Moreno. Moreno to win the Whitney in a wire-to-wire score.
Saturdays at Saratoga. Every Saturday this summer. Only on HRRN. Go to horseracingradio.net for a complete schedule or to listen live.
Jude Feld, the pontiff of the Pick 4. You hear him on HRRN Radio. Now get his personal selections directly from him at his new site, PopeJude.com. Every analysis sheet at PopeJude.com has his personal selections and insights. Each page is a handicapping lesson packed with years of racing knowledge, coupled with insider information gleaned from the pontiff's countless connections in thoroughbred racing. Whether you're looking for another set of eyes on the past performances or inspired racing analysis to assault the windows, PopeJude.com is the site for you.
The Arlington Million.
Little Mike close to the finish. Osiris closing, but time's up. Little Mike made every yard a winning one. And the
Apache found just a bit more than Real Solution. Close to the finish, and it's hard to score. Edge and clear at the 11-1. Hard to score has won.
The Arlington Million, Saturday, August 15th, beginning at 4:30 Eastern. Go to horseracingradio.net for more information or to listen live.
Hi, this is Chris McCarron, and you're listening to the best horse racing show on the radio on Horse Racing Radio Network.
Days that you will never forget if you are fortunate enough to be inducted into any Hall of Fame in your selected profession. But certainly here today at the National Museum of Racing and Hall of Fame in Saratoga Springs, we welcome four very deserving candidates in our 2015 class. Jockey Chris Antley, trainer King Leatherberry, and contemporary horses Lava Man and Extra Heat all being inducted here this morning, and happy to have you back with us on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, we are live from the Humphrey S. Finney Sales Pavilion in Saratoga Springs, and we are about 15 minutes away from the beginning of this ceremony here today. And when you talk about the history of Saratoga and you talk about the history of thoroughbred racing, you can't do it without talking about legendary trainer King Leatherberry, who will be inducted in just a little while, and Joe Clancy, his brother Sean. They both are very instrumental in following Maryland racing. They followed King Leatherberry for a very long time. They are the founders of ThisIsHorseRacing.com. They also produce a publication here in Saratoga called the Saratoga Special, which you can pick up when you come to the races. And Joe, nice enough to spend a few minutes with us now to talk about the King and how cool is it to see him finally get his due here today.
It's very cool. I mean, I grew up watching him at Delaware Park, watching him. We were stabled next to him at Timonium, and you kind of watched this operation. At first, you weren't sure what was going on because the trainer wasn't in the barn, you know, or he would show up to give the checks out and check on things. That was it. But that's the way he does it. I mean, he was a little bit ahead of his time. He was kind of handicapping where to run his horses even back then. And they've won 6,500, whatever the number is, races. And that number has stood the test of time, and it's an amazing, amazing treat to be here to see him get inducted and get his due.
Why do you think it was that it took so long?
I kind of get it. I mean, it's supposed to be the elite, you know, and he's running pretty much all on the Mid-Atlantic circuit. Every once in a while, he'd have a good horse. But, you know, guys like that, it takes extraordinary circumstances. It takes all those wins. It takes a career that's still going at 81 or however old he is. 82,
yeah.
At this point. You know, then he's still adding to it. He gets a horse like Ben's Cat, which puts him on a big stage and gets people talking about it. I mean, turf sprinter-wise, Ben's Cat's as good as anybody we've seen. You know, he doesn't show up at the Breeders' Cup, but he shows up everywhere else, and he's very tough, and, you know, King's done a great job with him. And I think guys like that that don't break out on the national stage and count on wins, not purse money piling up, it takes a little longer for whatever reason.
Well, it's not as if he hasn't won Grade 1 races. He has a couple of those to his credit. He won the Grade 1 Hempstead with Catatonic back in 1987, and then came back in 94 and took the Grade 1 Philip H. Island handicap with Taking Risks. So he can get a horse ready in a Grade 1 type of race.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, they can get a horse ready to do anything, watching them and just watching how they do things with the horses he's into. He's breeding horses. Ben's Cat's a homebred. You know, they kind of do a little bit of everything, and they make it work. And, yeah, I guess I hear it a lot of times with some other people on the list in terms of wins, but are, you know, just not national New York, California Grade 1, you know, Kentucky Derby, Triple Crown type races that sit on the bubble for a little while before they get in. And for whatever reason, I guess it's okay. You want it to be tough to get in, but you do want to see guys like King and some of the others get their due, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, it's so difficult to acquire those horses and have the chance to do it. And you know, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I think some of the guys that have actually won a lot of those races, a guy like Dave Hoffman's comes to mind. He's won classic races. He's won countless Grade Ones, and you know, his name's never on the list. And they go, this guy should absolutely be in the Hall of Fame. He's a very, very talented trainer. You know, But it's hard. It blows with the wind. It's kind of it's almost like a popularity contest, but not really.
Yeah. No, exactly. And I think it's you know the thing to focus on is he is getting in. You know, mm-hmm. and we do get a chance to see it and celebrate it, and I think that's great.
And I'm so happy for him because you know he's still alive. He gets to get the plaque. He gets to enjoy it, and that's so important. Sometimes. You know, people don't appreciate these guys until after they're gone, and then it's too late for them, you know. So it's great for him to have this experience today.
Joe, you did some amazing research and sent out a tweet this morning, which I found fascinating. King Leatherberry has actually won just one race here at Saratoga.
Yeah, he has told me the story for a better part of a year where it was at a Maryland Breeders Awards dinner, and he was telling me, he asked about the paper we do here, and he hadn't been inducted or elected yet, but he was asking about the Saratoga paper, and he said, you know, I had a horse win at Saratoga once, and so he, back in 1973, and he couldn't remember the horse's name or the year, and we did a little digging. I called a couple people. I emailed one guy who I thought would know the answer, and he did, crazily, and he claimed the horse from Jonathan Shepherd, we think at Delaware Park, 1973. The horse Jive was his name, and he went back and forth, flat and jump, and Leatherberry claimed him to be a flat horse. Had him at Delaware Park. The racing secretary in Saratoga had a jump race that Jive was eligible for. They needed a horse. They called Leatherberry and said, do you know that horse you claimed can jump? And he says, no, I didn't. So, in his words, I put him on the van, sent him up there, and he got his picture taken.
That's a classic.
An incredible story. How about his human counterpart here today? Jockey Chris Antley left us far too soon at the age of 34.
Yeah, I mean, you have long said, what would it have been? What would his career have been, you know, if his life didn't end the way it did? I mean, the talent, the skill, the big races he won, the streaks he put together of success, you know, tremendous. And same thing, I mean, it kind of had to pass through a few years and have all those numbers and that impact stand up, you know, to time a little bit. And I think it's a great honor, you know, when you talk to the people who knew him, it's, you know, it's phenomenal. They speak from the heart, everybody from, you know, Hammy and Gory Smith down in Ellery, South Carolina, and then, you know, all the way up here to his agents, Ron Anderson and Drew Malika and anybody he rode for. I imagine it will be very emotional.
Yeah, everybody loved the guy. I mean, you know, he's one of those guys that just had a lot of charisma. He's a lot of fun to be around, and he's a very caring, giving person. And, I'm happy for him, and I think you're right. I think it will be kind of bittersweet for a lot of people.
Yeah, I've often heard he was giving almost to a fault, where he would go out of his way to help somebody whatever they needed. Didn't matter who it was, he would go out of his way, and that really, to me, speaks volumes as to his character and to what he really represents and why he deserves to be in this Hall of Fame today.
Yeah, definitely. And he was a little, I mean, I watched him more as a fan. I wasn't a writer at that point, but you certainly saw the proof that he could ride with anybody, you know, and that's what you talk. You talk to the guys today, John Velasquez and the rest of them. Yeah, he was as good as anybody.
Yeah.
You know, and that to me, you know, so that, again, passes a few years, enough years pass where you go, hey, look at that. Antley's numbers still stand up to that, and you kind of project a little bit, even though you don't really, you know, you don't want to invent wins for somebody, but you project a little bit and go, yeah, he's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah. Yeah. Two horses getting into the Hall of Fame this year. Lava Man, Extra Heat. You got a chance to see Extra Heat quite a bit down there in the Mid-Atlantic states.
She was a beast, as they say. I mean, and a great story for everybody. I mean, they bought her very inexpensively as a two-year-old at Timonium. And as John Salzman tells me, everybody says they were the underbidder.
Yeah.
but she only sold for $5,000, so I don't know. You know.
Yeah, there's a horse in that with a $5,000 yearling he's in tomorrow, Swipe. In the Best Pal, grade two. He's already made $88,000. I'm sure he's got the same thing going. Everybody says, oh, I was a keen one. You couldn't come up with the extra 500?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Just an amazing story. And, of course, Lava Man, we talked about him earlier. We played that clip of him winning his third consecutive Hollywood Gold Cup. I referred to him as maybe the greatest claim in the history of thoroughbred racing. Agree?
Yeah, he'd be pretty high up there, that's for sure. I was talking to somebody this morning, and they were looking for horses to buy, and they'd say, well, because I like to vet them, I like to look at them. I said, lots of people claim horses, it works. I don't want to do that. I said, well, Lava Man later today is going in the Hall of Fame. They might not have wanted to do it, but what happened? You know, so.
Yeah, it's very cool. But before you go, talk about Alfred Gwynne Vanderbilt a little bit. You're a Maryland guy.
the legacy he had at Sagamore Farms amazing. I mean, you know, Kevin Plank and the Under Armour people have fixed it up now, but, you know, you would drive through there and see that sprawling facility and just go, you know, you'd have these visions of what it must have been like when Native Dancer and the, you know, Discovery and the Stars that they were cranking out trained there, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, you kind of come around the corner of basically farmland, and there it is, this Thoroughbred Oasis. And, yeah, I mean, that, you know, he was as big of an owner as we, or breeder as anybody had, you know, in the country, you know. And then he stepped up and did the things at the racetrack. I mean, he was the president of Pimlico. He was the general manager up at the Naira tracks. He was the guy who put together the Seabiscuit War Admiral match race. I mean, you know, big impact in the game, that's for sure.
Yeah, he was a very nice man. I got to meet him at Santa Anita at Clocker's Corner one morning when he was campaigning horses at Santa Anita. When Robin Smith was riding for him, that was back in the day. Wow. I think I was in high school, but Laz Barrera introduced me to him, and it was a humbling experience to even meet the guy, because I knew he was a special man in racing, and he's a very famous guy. That he's got the Norman Rockwell painting in with his silks and all that, and just really cool that he's finally going in. I would have thought he'd been in a long time ago.
Yeah, and it's funny that that category they've created, Pillars of the Turf, you know, is where owners and breeders finally get a little recognition like that, you know, which is fun. I mean, it does add depth to it, and it certainly makes you go back and look at the historical value of some of this stuff.
Yeah, sure. Alfred Quinn Vanderbilt, the breeder of 77 stakes winners. He owned 3 Hall of Fame horses. He will be inducted along with John Hay Whitney, who was a racing industry leader, the breeder of 91 stakes winners at Greentree, and owner of Hall of Famer Tom Fool. So they will go into that other category that you just mentioned, the Turf Pillars of the Turf Hall of Fame honorees. So we're looking forward to seeing that. And by the way, the induction of the Historic Review Hall of Fame honorees is going to welcome Billy Kelly and Vincent Power. So a really special day coming forward here in just a few moments.
No, it's fun. It's a full slate, and I love doing this. I've never been to the Baseball Hall of Fame induction, but I'm sure it's a similar feel. You know, I love that the public can come and take part in it, yeah. You know, and get the feel of it.
This place is packed.
Yeah, that's fun.
Well, you know how important it is if Andy Beyer shows up.
Hey, the Clancys are in the house, all 22 of them, or whatever there are now. They're everywhere.
There's a few back home, too. We left a few home. They'll be back up next week.
All right, Joe Clancy. Saratoga Special, this is horseracing.com, is where you can find more from Joe Clancy, his brother Sean, Tom Law, all of their great writers. This is horseracing.com. Appreciate it, my friend. Enjoy the day.
Thank you.
All right, and a special day indeed coming up in just a few minutes. We're about 3 minutes away from the kickoff to this year's Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Sam the Bugler, the longtime New York Bugler, is going to come out to the podium. He will make the call to the post, and we will be set to get underway. And Drew, we mentioned it will begin with welcoming all of the past Hall of Fame members that are in attendance here today. And we've seen so many of them here throughout the week. We talked about it at the top of the show. Braulio Baeza Sr. making his way back here. He'll be in attendance for the first time at the Hall of Fame since being inducted. We'll get a chance to see Angel Cordero Jr. and Pat Day and just so many of the greats that have come here. Nick Zito on the training side, Shug McGahee. Really is a special moment when these Hall of Fame members come walking out.
Yeah, it's really cool to see them all together. It's a great experience and something I always enjoy.
All right, we're going to step away for a quick break, and we will be right back right after this to kick off the Hall of Fame inductions on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is HRRN, your exclusive home for the Breeders' Cup World Championships.
Every morning in Maryland, a new day dawns on more than 16,000 horse farms. From the mountains to the ocean and all along the Chesapeake Bay, new life surges from paddock to field to track, energizing the old line state's grandest sport. Maryland, we grow horses.
To learn more about racing and breeding in Maryland, visit MarylandThoroughbred.com.
HRRN's Saturdays at Saratoga series continues tomorrow with the Whitney and the Test Stakes. Tune in beginning at 5 p.m. Eastern for live stakes racing from the Spa.
And it's Moreno to win the Whitney in a wire-to-wire score.
Saturdays at Saratoga, every Saturday this summer, only on HRRN. Go to horseracingradio.net for a complete schedule or to listen live.
Hello, this is Bill Mott. You're listening to Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Saratoga Springs, New York, and the Fasig Tipton Sales Pavilion as we get set to begin the 2015 Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, our producer, Michelle Penna. We are positioned just in front of this stage, and it is going to be a very special morning. We're happy to have you with us on this coverage, all presented by the Maryland Horse Breeders Association, as it should be, with the fact that one of their own, King Leatherberry, born in Baltimore, is being inducted at the age of 82. He is one of the top trainers that we've ever seen in this sport, and nice to see him getting his due in just a little bit.
Yeah, it's going to be great to see him, hear what he has to say, and we may get lucky and have him on later in the show.
Yeah, he is supposed to join us after he's inducted. We'll see if we can corral him over to our position here. It would be great to visit with the new Hall of Fame trainer, King Leatherberry, here after we finish up the ceremonies. Tom Durkin is the master of ceremony, the former announcer here at Saratoga and a longtime announcer with the New York Racing Association, retired after last year's meet. He is going to handle the MC duties, and it should be a magical morning in just a few moments. JT, a good opportunity for us to let people know what they can expect coming up here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, because this is just the beginning of a very busy weekend for us. We are back tomorrow morning, 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern, with our Saturday morning Equine Forum show. Then we're back tomorrow afternoon from 5 to 6 to broadcast the Grade 1 Test Stakes and that spectacular renewal of the Grade 1 Whitney, which you'll hear 5 to 6 Eastern right here. Then we come back Monday and Tuesday evening with our exclusive coverage of the Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale. 7 o'clock Eastern will take you gavel to gavel, and that is a sale presented by Embrace the Race, by the way, at least our coverage is. But that sale is so spectacular. You see so many of the top future stars of our sport in one of the fun shows that we do throughout the year.
Yeah, we do a lot of fun shows, actually.
That's but, right up there. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's great. You know, sometimes celebrities that are buying horses come by. We get to shoot the breeze with them and, you know, the trainers. And we always have some good interviews, find out why people pick a certain horse. Very interesting to see the thought process behind buying some of these very expensive yearlings that they offer at Saratoga.
Yeah, I love to talk with the consigners, too, and just kind of get a sense of what they saw in that young horse as they were prepping them for the sale. And when did they kind of know that, hey, this horse was special, and maybe he could bring $1 million at the auction, you know? And those kind of stories, to me, are just fascinating.
Yeah, well, that's what it's all about. I mean, people that breed commercially, they need those horses to keep their operation afloat, and it's great when you have a very nice yearling and he gets selected to be sold at Saratoga.
Well, again, you can catch that coverage Monday and Tuesday evening beginning at 7 o'clock Eastern. You can listen right here on our website, horseracingradio.net, and you can also tune in nationwide on Sirius Channel 93. And again, tomorrow's coverage, 8 to 10 Eastern with the Equine Forum. That will kick off our Whitney Handicap Day from Saratoga, and we're back 5 to 6 Eastern tomorrow afternoon to bring you the Whitney and the test. Go to our website, horseracingradio.net, for a complete listing of affiliates, SiriusXM channel information, and as always, to listen online and on your smartphone, on your tablet, however you want to tune in, you can do it right there, horseracingradio.net.
Yeah, what a great card at Saratoga tomorrow. Just a bunch of stakes and really nice racing. It's
how
going to be very exciting.
Yeah. Seven awesome. Grade 1 winners.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Including the defending champ in Moreno.
going to be a lot of fun, and the test is excellent as well, and there's a couple of Fasig Tipton-sponsored stakes that are pretty salty. It's going to be a really, really fun day of racing.
By the way, Hall of Famer Pat Day, one of the winningest jockeys of all time, is going to be with us on the Equine Forum show tomorrow, and his name, as it is with so many graded stakes around the country, is right up at the top of the list with the Whitney Handicap, now the Whitney Stakes, but he is tied with Jerry Bailey for most wins in the race with 5. And I ran into him as we were walking out of the racetrack yesterday morning. And we went through each of those five, and I can't wait to visit with him on the show tomorrow because his eyes lit up as he started remembering those moments in his career. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a lot of fun to catch up with Pat Day tomorrow morning.
Yeah, he's such a class act, great guy. I love Pat Day, and it'll be a lot of fun to talk to him.
Of course, if you missed any of our programming this past week, Trainer Talk, my hour-long visit with Steve Asmussen, that was on Wednesday evening, that show presented by Fasig Tipton. And on Tuesday, I had a chance to sit down with Irad Ortiz Jr. and Jose Ortiz on our Jock Talk program presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. That show, every single Tuesday night, myself and Christina McManigal. And each of those was just unbelievable. You saw a side of Steve Asmussen that you rarely see in that hour visit. And go back and listen. The Ortiz brothers, what can you say, as classy as they come.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. It's always fun when you can get those brother acts on the radio. You never know what they're going to pop off with.
No, and they had a lot of fun with each other because not only are they very close, but they are very competitive as right. well. So they had some great information there, too. All right, Brian Boyer from the Hall of Fame making an announcement that will be underway here shortly with the 2015 Hall of Fame inductions. Again, Master of Ceremonies, Tom Durkin will welcome everybody and will be started in just a couple. You're going to hear all of it right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, and then we're back afterwards with a wrap-up show, which is going to include Hall of Famer King Leatherberry, so you won't want to miss that. Looking forward to catching up with him after he is officially inducted. But if you are just joining us, four members going into this year's Hall of Fame class: jockey Chris Antley, trainer King Leatherberry, and racehorses Lava Man and Extra Heat. And you could hear a pin drop in here now, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Especially if I wasn't.
Everybody's quiet but you.
Yeah, everybody's quiet but me and my cell phone, apparently. Remember the first Hall of Fame class inducted in 1955. We welcome another one as Sam the Bugler welcomes you to the Hall of Fame.
The National Museum of Racing has recognized and honored the achievements of those horses, jockeys, and trainers whose records and reputations have withstood the test of time in the great sport of thoroughbred racing. This class is no exception. Itself representing over 10,000 wins, exciting thousands of fans for more than a century. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 2015 National Museum of Racing's Hall of Fame induction ceremony. At this time, please welcome the voice of the Breeders' Cup for its first 21 years and the voice of the New York Racing Association from 1990 through his retirement in 2014. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Tom Durkin.
Thank you, everybody. Another beautiful Chamber of Commerce day here at the Spa. But before we begin, I'd like to do something as a group, a group exercise, a sort of communal cleansing, if you will. So if we could all, at the same right time right now, as a group, take out these damn cell phones and turn them off. Could you do that now? All right. And with that, welcome to the 2015 National Museum and Racing Hall of Fame induction ceremonies. It's my happy privilege to be here again today with you and with all of the new inductees. It's a great day for them, and it's a great day for horse racing itself. A lot of good reasons why we're here today to enshrine these great figures in the hall, because the hall, among its several purposes, is a place, in fact, it's a pantheon, where forever preserved are the exploits and accomplishments of our sports heroes. It will never, we will never, be able to forget our storied past. This is our shared patrimony. The Hall of Fame is a reliquary of horse racing excellence. And just one example of that excellence, just one of scores, perhaps hundreds of examples. Let's just take Citation, for instance. Many of you probably know, 1948, he won the Triple Crown. In fact, the Museum and the Hall of Fame reminds us of that. Yes, he won the Derby, but did you know that that Derby, they barred place and show wagering? Imagine that. Win wagering only on the Kentucky Derby, which is a reminder to us all that even back then, Churchill Downs Incorporated had a keen eye on the bottom line. That was a little catty, I know. So after he wins the Kentucky Derby, goes down to Pimlico, wins the Preakness, and then on his way to Belmont Park, stops off in New Jersey and wins the Jersey Derby. And then he goes on to win the Belmont Stakes. He wins the Triple Crown and his own personal quadruple crown. Oh, by the way, Citation won the Kentucky Derby on 4 days rest. That fall, Citation goes on and wins the Sisonby Stakes at Aqueduct. And then on 3 days rest, wins the 2 mile Jockey Club Gold Cup. Of the 19 races that he won, the museum reminds us, in that three-year-old season of his, perhaps the quirkiest of them all was the Pimlico Special, in which he basically had no competition. No, he literally had no competition. He was the only horse that ran. It was a walkover. These are the epic tales that are preserved here on Union Avenue. These heroics will never be lost in the fog of time because of the Museum of Racing and Hall of Fame. Today we are going to induct some new names in that shrine. There are names that you probably know: King Leatherberry, Chris Antley, Alfred Vanderbilt, John Hay Whitney, Lava Man, Extra Heat. You probably know those names. But we'll also induct two others today whose names, if you're like me, you're probably not familiar with: Vincent Powers and Billy Kelly. Billy Kelly was not a person. Billy Kelly was a horse. In fact, a very good horse. But it were it not for the Hall of Fame, the fact that there was a very good horse named Billy Kelly, and the fact that he was, in fact, a horse, not a person, probably may have well been lost in that fog of time. Because at the National Museum of Racing and Hall of Fame, the weather's always clear and the track is always fast. So here, let us begin. Ed Bowen, the wind, excuse me, not, are we doing Ed yet? No, we're doing Gretchen. Gretchen, then we'll get to Ed. Beauty before age. Gretchen Jackson, you may know from the great exploits of Barbaro and Barbaro's four full little brothers. She is currently the National Museum of Racing and Hall of Fame president. Ladies and gentlemen, Gretchen Jackson.
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to welcome you to the ceremony for the Hall of Fame inductees. At this time, we wish to thank Daisy Tipton for the facility, Keeneland Broadcasting Company for the videotaping of the ceremony, Naira, Stronic Group, Maserati of Albany, and Kendall Jackson. Thank you so much.
Gretchen, you would have been a very bad track announcer. You just don't speak long enough. And now may I introduce now the wind beneath the wings of the nominating committee for the Hall of Fame here perennially, Ed Bowen.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to introduce returning Hall of Famers. It's always a delicate balance between wanting the program to move along and giving justice to these extraordinary careers. So if I don't mention your favorite race or victory, please forgive me. First up is Jerry Bailey, class of 1995. He's been in the Hall a long time. Jerry led all North American jockeys in earnings 7 times. He won 7 Eclipse Awards, more than any other jockey. He won almost 6,000 races and ran second all-time in earnings with almost $300 million. He won the Derby, Preakness, and Belmont twice each, which is a nice touch. He won 15 Breeders' Cups.
Yeah, I think you're back on.
Hello?
Okay. Just give a couple punches with that.
Okay, there you go. That's okay. Donald Trump's going to be here later, and we need that. We need this microphone working. Okay.
That microphone punched me a few times, too.
Well, anyway, Jerry's 15 Breeders' Cups included 5 runnings of the Classic, one, of course, on the Cigar. And Jerry won a record 6 hopefuls, 5 Whitneys, 5 Hollywood Gold Cups, a record 4 Dubai World Cups, and that race hadn't been run all that long, and 3 Travers. Since his retirement, he has delivered expert racing comment analysis on national television. Jerry Bailey, please come and start the line standing here, please.
Yeah.
Eddie Maple, class of 2009. Eddie won almost 4,400 races and more than $100 million in 34 years in the irons. He won the Belmont Stakes in 1990 with Temperance Hill and again in 1985 with Creme Fraiche. He won the Travers Stakes 3 times, the Saranac 7 times, Saratoga Special 5 times, the Dwyer 4 times, the Manhattan and Metropolitan Mile each 3 times, and the Alabama twice. He was awarded the George Wolfe Award in 1995 and the Mike Venezia Award in 1998. He also rode the Great Secretariat to victory in the Big Red's final race, the Canadian International, in 1973. Eddie Maple. Leroy Jolly. In 1980, Leroy became the second man to win the Kentucky Derby with a filly. He was a 2-time winner of the Kentucky Derby, taking the race with the Foolish Pleasure and also the filly Genuine Risk. Both of those are Hall of Famers. He's trained a 3rd Hall of Famer in Manila, as well as such standouts as Rydan, Meadowstar, General Assembly, Honest Pleasure, and Gulch. Among his major other victories were multiple editions of the Travers, Whitney, Bluegrass, Wood Memorial, Florida Derby, Frisette, Matron in the United Nations. Leroy Jolly. Next is Edgar Prado, the class of 2008. I have never felt more superfluous than when I introduced him when he was given the award, because the applause was such that it made it clear that telling you about him was kind of wasteful. So anyway, I get to tell him about it again. Edgar dominated the Maryland tracks before establishing himself as a fixture on the New York circuit. He was Maryland's leading rider for 6 years and has won 10 riding titles since then in New York, including 3 at Saratoga. He won the Kentucky Derby, of course, in 2006 with Barbaro and was named the Eclipse Award winner that year. He's a 2-time winner of the Belmont. Edgar has almost 7,000 career race wins and ranks 8th over time, all time. He has also earned more than $255 million in purses, ranking 7th. He led the nation in wins 3 times, and in 1997, he became only the 4th rider to win more than 500 races in a single year. Edgar Prado. Jacinto Vasquez, class of 1998. We spoke of Genuine Risk earlier in connection to Leroy Jolly. Jacinto rode Genuine Risk, and he also rode such Hall of Famers as Ruffian, Foolish Pleasure, Manila, and Forgo. He won more than 5,200 races and as well as piloting some of those great horses. He had earnings of more than $85 million in that era, and he did win the Kentucky Derby twice. Of the 5 times that the Immortal Secretariat was defeated, Jacinto rode the winning horse 3 times. I don't know if the Chinnery family likes that or not, but Jacinto owns multiple victories in such major races as the Travers, Mother Goose, Test, Wood Memorial, Champagne, Coaching Club American Oaks, Brooklyn Handicap in its heyday, and the Bluegrass Stakes. Jacinto Vasquez. Jerry Fishback. Jerry was the leading North American steeplechase jockey five times during the 1970s and is tied for third all-time with 301 jump victories. Fishback rode Hall of Famers Cafe, Prince, and Flatterer, as well as standouts Shadowbrook and Soothsayer. Jerry won the Temple Gwathemi and the Tom Robey steeplechase six times each and the Colonial Cup four times, including three consecutive editions with the amazing Flatterer. Fishback retired in 1979, but returned 6 years later to lead the standings again in 1985 before Jerry's final retirement in 1987. Jerry Fishback. Braulio Baeza, class of 1976. Doesn't seem that long ago, but I guess it is in some people's minds. Braulio won Eclipse Awards in 1972 and 75 and rode such Hall of Fame horses as Buck Passer, Dr. Fager, Ack-Ack, Arts and Letters, and Foolish Pleasure. Wow. He led North American riders in earnings each year from 1965 through 1969. He won the Belmont three times, the Derby once, the Travers four times, the Jockey Club Gold Cup three times, and the Whitney twice. He won more than 3,000 races in North America and almost 900 more in his native Panama for a total of 4,000 wins. During the era of a few contract riders, he rode a contract for Darby Dan, and as such, he was the jockey of horses like Graustark, Shadow Gay, and Primonetta. Braulio Baeza. Chris McCarron, class of 1989. Chris won the Eclipse Award for Outstanding Apprentice in 1974 and a second Eclipse in 1980. He won more than 7,100 races and had earnings of more than $263 million. He ranks fourth all-time in earnings and sixth in wins. He won six Triple Crown races, taking the Kentucky Derby, Preakness, and Belmont twice each. He won nine Breeders' Cup events, including five editions of the Breeders' Cup Classic. Chris led all North American jockeys in earnings four times and in wins three times. He later founded the forerunner of the North American Riding Academy in Lexington, teaching young jockeys and others looking to enter the racing industry the skills necessary to succeed on and off the racetrack. A great service to the sport. Chris McCarron. John Velasquez. John is the all-time leading jockey in purse earnings with $329 million, and he has 53 career wins. In 2013, just 2 years ago, he became the all-time leading rider at Saratoga, where he has won five riding titles. He has won a total of 26 riding titles in the New York circuit. He has won editions of the Belmont, a Kentucky Derby, two editions of the Belmont, and also won the Derby. John has won 13 Breeders' Cup races and multiple editions of the Whitney, Alabama, Sanford, King's Bishop, Test, and four-star Dave, John Velasquez. Jonathan Shepherd, class of 1990. Jonathan is one of only two trainers to condition champions over the jumps and also on the flat. He has trained a total of nine champions, including multiple steeplechase Eclipse Award winners, Flatterer and Cafe Prince, both of whom are Hall of Fame members, as well as the Turf Champion Forever Together on the flat. He has led all steeplechase trainers in earnings a record 28 times, and in 2010 became the first trainer to record his 1,000th career victory over the jumps. He won his 3,000th overall race in 2012, and he is all-time leader in steeplechase earnings with more than $22 million. He led all trainers in wins at Saratoga in 1984 and 85, and has won at least one race here at the Spa for a remarkable 46 years. He was also presented the F. Ambrose Clark Award in 2013. Sorry, Jonathan. We're all about honoring the past here, you know. So, Jonathan Shepherd. Janet Elliott, class of 2009. Janet became only the second woman inducted into the Hall of Fame and the first woman trainer enshrined. An assistant to Hall of Famer Mr. Shepard for 11 years, Janet won her own in 1979 and has trained some of the top steeplechasers in the game, including Eclipse Award winners Flat Top and Correggio. She ended Jonathan's 18-year run as leading money-winning steeplechase trainer in 1991 and also led that list, and she also led the list of wins that year. Janet topped all steeplechase trainers in earnings a second time in 1998. She won the inaugural Breeders' Cup steeplechase in 1986 with Census and won the race again with Flat Top in 2002. Janet has won the Colonial Cup 6 times, the Iroquois 5 times, the Temple Gwathme 4 times, and the American Grand National 3 times. Janet Elliott. Manuel Icaza, class of 1977. Manny won 4 riding championships at Saratoga, including 41 wins in 1959 to break a record that had stood for 38 years. And remember, it was a much shorter meeting in 1959. At Saratoga, he won multiple editions of the Travers, Hopeful, Saratoga Special, and Bernard Veruque. He also won the Whitney, Alabama, Sanford, and Spinaway. Manny won the 1964 Belmont with Quadrangle to thwart Northern Dancer's bid for a Triple Crown. In 1968, he rode the first filly ever to win the New York Triple Crown, Handicap Filly Triple Crown, the Acorn Mother Goose and Coaching Club Oaks, as it was then, and that was the Little Filly Dark Mirage. He won 2,367 career races. One of the peak eras of his career came when he was contract rider for Captain Guggenheim's Canehoy Stable with trainer Woody Stevens. And that triumvirate rode such campaigned such horses as Never Been, Bald Eagle, Iron Peg. And Manny also won a $7,500 claiming race in Monmouth Park in 1962 on Wallingford. He might remember it. He might not remember it, but I do because I was the groom. Manny Icaza. Bobby Ussery, class of 1980. Bobby won more than 3,600 races, including the Kentucky Derby on Proud Clarion in 1967 and the Preakness on Valley Ache in 1960. He won his first career race in 1951 at Fairgrounds, and he rode until 1974. He set a record in New York with 215 wins in 1959, and he was the 10th jockey in history to surpass 3,000 wins. His major victories included the Travers, Whitney, Alabama, Queensplate, Met Mile, Wood Memorial, and Coaching Club American Oaks. Bobby Ussery. Next up is Nick Zito, class of 2005. Nick has won the Kentucky Derby twice, with Strike the Gold in 1991 and Go for Gin only 3 years later. He also won the Preakness in 1996 with Louis Couture's, and he ended 2 Triple Crown bids with his Belmont Stakes victories by Birdstone in 2004 and Datara in 2008. Nick has won almost 2,000 career races now and ranks 12th all-time in earnings with more than $107 million. His other major wins include the Travers, Whitney, Jockey Club Gold Cup, Florida Derby, Kentucky Oaks, Wood Memorial, Champaign, Bluegrass, Acorn, Don Handicap, and the Flower Bowl. Nick Zito. Pat Day, class of 1991. A 4-time Eclipse Award winner, Pat won 9 Triple Crown races, including 5 editions of the Preakness in his 32-year career. He is a winner of 12 Breeders' Cup races, including the Classic 4 times. Pat finished his career with 8,800 wins and almost $300 million in earnings, the all-time record at the time of his retirement. He led all North American riders in 6 wins and is the all-time leading rider at Churchill Downs. He won multiple editions of the Travers, Jockey Club, Gold Cup, Park Handicap, Bluegrass, Kentucky Oaks, Stephen Foster, and Apple Blossom, among others. As a further indication of the esteem he has at Churchill Downs, they named a stakes race for him this year. Pat Day. Angel Cordero, class of 1988. In a career spanning four decades, Angel Cordero won more than 7,000 races, and he ranked seventh all-time, and more than 164 million. He was dubbed the King of Saratoga thanks to his record of 14 Spa riding titles. Angel won the Eclipse Award for Outstanding Jockey in 1982 and 1983. He led all riders in earnings three times and in victories once. He won the Kentucky Derby three times, the Preakness twice, and the Belmont once. Angel won the Personal Ensign eight times, the Woodward and Vosburgh six times each, and four Breeders' Cup races. Still one of the most popular figures in the sport, Angel is now a jockey agent for 2012 Hall of Fame inductee John Velasquez, and he also has under his wing the young apprentice Manny Franco. Angel Cordero. Brian Bouye of the museum had come up with a wonderful statistic that all the expected, anticipated returning Hall of Famers won a total of 85,000 races. Even those that didn't get here today, even with that, I'm sure this group accounted for 80,000 races. So, ladies and gentlemen, what do you say to collective greatness? Thank you. We move on now to the pillars of the turf. Several years ago, the museum added this category. It honors individuals who have made extraordinary contributions to thoroughbred racing in a leadership or pioneering capacity at the highest national level. Candidates must be deemed to have represented the sport with indisputable standards of integrity and commitment through disciplines including, but not limited to, innovation, philanthropy, promotion, and education, as well as breeding and owning horses. Today we honor posthumously two of the great men of the 20th century. We identify the categories as prior to 1950 and after 1950, but both of these gentlemen certainly were important leaders in both eras. These gentlemen are Alfred Vanderbilt and John Hay Whitney. So let's see the video on Mr. Vanderbilt first. Thank you.
Alfred Gwynn Vanderbilt was involved in thoroughbred racing during seven decades of the 20th century and contributed to the game in ways that continue to benefit to this date. Vanderbilt was born in 1912 in London and was raised in Lenox, Massachusetts by his mother, Margaret Emerson. It was the Emerson family that built the Maryland farm that became Sagamore, which young Vanderbilt inherited on his 21st birthday. Under Vanderbilt's direction, Sagamore evolved into a legendary breeding and racing operation that continues to flow in contemporary bloodlines. An anchor of that legacy was Discovery, a Vanderbilt purchase and the first handicap champion to win such honors when formal voting began in 1936. Discovery won 22 stakes races, including the Whitney in Brooklyn three times each in succession, and was elected to the Hall of Fame in 1969. Retired to Sagamore Farm, Discovery sired 25 stakes winners, one of which was the filly Miss Disco, bred by Vanderbilt. She became the mother of Bold Ruler, sire of Triple Crown winner Secretariat, and one of the greatest stallions of the 20th century. His line survives through A.P. Endy, the son of Triple Crown winner Seattle Slough. At this time, while in his 20s, Vanderbilt became director at Pimlico and worked to bring about the famous match race between Seabiscuit and Triple Crown winner War Admiral in 1938. In 1940, Vanderbilt became president of the Westchester Racing Association, the operator of Belmont Park, and helped bring the parimutuel era to New York. He then left racing to serve his country as a PT boat commander in the Pacific during World War II, earning a Silver Star for bravery. Vanderbilt's thoroughbred masterpiece was the immortal Native Dancer, a foal of 1950 who won four stakes in 26 days as a two-year-old at Saratoga. The Flash, Special, Grand Union, and Hopeful. His other major victories included the Wood Memorial, Preakness, Belmont, and Travers. His only defeat was by the slightest of margins in the Kentucky Derby, as he won 21 of his 22 lifetime starts. Along with his tenure as president of Belmont Park, Vanderbilt was also chairman of the New York Racing Association from 1971 through 1975. Vanderbilt's association with New York racing coincided with decades of Eastern greatness, which was no coincidence. During his final years, Vanderbilt remained present to mingle with friends and fans, talking about the serious issues of the day, whether on the backstretch or in the paddock. Late in life, Vanderbilt enjoyed a glorious moment in 1996 when his Traitor won the Grade 1 Futurity at Belmont Park.
And it is Traitor! He wins by 5! And there he is, the happy owner, the venerable Alfred G. Vanderbilt, the leading owner in the United States in 1935.
It was the final addition to a list of coveted trophies that Vanderbilt won. Vanderbilt attended morning workouts on a daily basis until the day he died, November 12, 1999.
That's wonderful. And it's now my... It's my pleasure to ask Alfred Wynn Vanderbilt III to come up to the podium. I can't help taking a little bit of extra time. I was privileged to know Mr. Vanderbilt late in his life as his eyesight diminished, and my wife and I did an informal survey of his basement, and I will spare you the hour of talking about the glories we found. But Mr. Vanderbilt was known for a what I think was called a puckish sense of humor, and obviously when you read and own Native Dancer and you're that far from undefeated status and amazing immortality, he was not all that enamored of the Secretariat statue in the Belmont paddock. I was standing there looking at it with him one day, and he said, you know, there's room on the end to list the horses that beat him. And then in the perfect Vanderbilt squelch, he said, or maybe it would take both ends. Anyway, he was a wonderful sportsman. I'm so thrilled that the Gray Ghost is with us in bronze in Saratoga, and now I'll turn this over to Mr. Vanderbilt.
Thank you all, and thank you, Ed Bowen, and thank you to the National Museum of Racing for creating this category, and especially to the Hall of Fame Committee, which allows men like my dad to be recognized. I do want to thank Mary Lou Whitney and John Hendrickson for that beautiful statue. It's just... It's beautiful and it's touching. I think if you wanted to live a racing life in the 20th century, the life you would have wanted to live was my father's. He was personally a charming guy. He was funny. He was witty. He was down to earth. He'd make you feel good about yourself. He was easy, always quick with a quip, and great fun to be around. From 1923, when his grandfather took him to his first race, to 1999, when he died coming back from the morning workouts, I don't think anybody lived a life that was more deeply ingrained in the sport of racing. He was considered profound by his generation as a young man, and not just a reflection of his ancestry, but of his accomplishments. His father had been one of the most famous Americans of the century and had been one of the greatest horsemen of his time. He was the heir to Cornelius Vanderbilt and a hero of the Lusitania sinking. One of his uncles built Grand Central Terminal, an aunt built the Whitney Museum of American Art, and that was just the generation above him. He enjoyed nationwide fame in a way that is probably only possible in the 1930s and 40s. He grew up with his mother, Margaret Emerson, who sort of patrolled the East Coast in her private rail car going from estate to estate. At St. Paul's School, he was the school bookie, showing his, exhibiting his early interest in the horses. He repeated the practice when he went to Yale. After he lost his father at the age of three, he was then nearly killed twice, once quite violently. And so when his grandfather took him to the Preakness in 1923, it was his first horse race, and he bet on a horse called Tall Timber, and Tall Timber lost in a head bobber, a screamer at the wire. And then there was an inquiry, and Tall Timber was declared the winner. He said it was the most exciting thing in his life, and it absolutely hooked him on racing. I think he saw the door to the world open up in front of him after all those tough times. The record says he started racing at 21, but he probably started sooner. His grandmother raced while he grew up under her own silks, cerise and white squares. But he almost certainly started working with Bud Stotler, her trainer. And when he took over the farm, he tipped the squares on their sides to create cerise and white diamonds. He had a bedroom set up in one of the barns at Sagamore so he could be involved in everything. He bought Pimlico when he was only 20 years old. He inherited Sagamore when he was 21. And at 25, he set the greatest match race of the century between Seabiscuit and War Admiral. When World War II intervened, he lost his dream job. He was president of Belmont Park. But he rose to a greater challenge. He fought for his country and brought his men home safely. And he was awarded the Silver Star for bravery under fire. When he returned to racing, he married my mother, proving his bravery yet again. Although he came from one of America's oldest clans, he considered himself a modern man, and he was. He liked to drive himself, often with his chauffeur in the back seat. He had a butler, a wonderful man named Louis Sherry. One day while Louis was waiting for my dad at the track, he struck up a conversation with a couple of men at the rail, and Louis was a Frenchman, and he said, you know, it looks very expensive, horse racing. The next thing my father knew, the butler had two horses. I was incredibly lucky to land in my mother's arms. The world my parents occupied was filled with interesting and influential friends, beautiful homes, and wonderful experiences. They really knew everyone who was worth knowing. They knew Amelia Earhart. They knew Ernest Hemingway, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, the Prince of Wales. My father invested in the Broadway shows of George Abbott and Harold Prince, and he would host softball games between his stable hands and, for instance, the cast of West Side Story. One morning when we were very little, before dawn, he drove us out to a railhead in Maryland. And his stable was being moved to the West Coast for the racing season. He had 87 horses in training. They were all being loaded. There were about 125 men there and almost 90 horses. Afterwards, I was told it was one of the largest mobilizations of land animals in North America. My dad's core belief was that the horseman's goal was to breed his best on his own land and to race them to win. He came from the era when insurance costs were negligible, trainers worked for one owner, made a little, jockeys made much less. He never expected to turn a profit on his sport, but he always tried to make it rewarding for everyone who he was involved with. He championed the jockeys' cause again and again. His trainers were all wonderful, and I just want to mention them. Bud Stotler, who was his mother's trainer, he said, taught him everything. George Poole, Bobby Lake, Mike Freeman, Elliot Birch, Rick Violet, Mary Epler, and Alan Jerkins all worked for him. And he trained his own in between. He was that involved in the sport. He was not a hands-off owner. He was a member of racing's establishment and one of its most ardent critics. But he talked about his career this way. He said there were really three eras, BW, AW, and W. And W stood for Winfrey. And he said the only matter when he the only era when he mattered was during Winfrey. He loved his times in Saratoga and looked forward to the season here every year. He staged epic all-night charades parties, played tennis on the public courts, and went to the racetrack every day. This was his slice of heaven. One day he called me and asked if I could meet him out at Belmont for the fifth race. He said it was a terrible race. He had a bad horse in it and no chance of winning. So, of course, I went. And I recognized the two men who brought his horse up. They had both been with him for 40 years. One was a man named Apples, Claude Apley, who had been assistant trainer under Lucien Loren. And the other one was Harold Washington, who had been his chief of security during the days of Native Dancer. I shook Mr. Washington's hand and noticed that he was missing a couple of fingers. And he said, oh, he said, don't worry about that. He said, that was that big gray horse of your father's that did that to me. He said, the one that should have won the Triple Crown. He said, I went in there at feeding time without the feed bag. And he said, no rookie will do that. But he said, Native Dancer just said, I think I'll have a couple of these fat carrots until my dinner arrives. And then I spoke to Apples, who had been with him 37 years. And I said to him, what was my dad like to work for? He said, I wish I had the money he spent on funerals. And I thought, I don't know what that means. What do you mean by that? He said, well, you know, he said, the people on the farm really didn't have all that much. And if someone in your family died, your dad would pay for the funeral. So we went upstairs and we watched his horse run, came in fifth or sixth, I don't remember. But he had wanted me to be there to see that, to see the last time he would bring a horse up with his own men from Maryland. So he was grateful to have lived the life he did and to have enjoyed the extraordinary experiences, the great friendships, and the family, not just his own family, but he considered the racing community his family, the backstretch people especially. His life was a fine race, a fine racing life, perhaps, in my opinion, the finest ever. So I thank the National Museum of Racing, and I thank you all very much.
We move now to the second half of an amazing daily double, and that's John Hay Whitney, who was a contemporary of Mr. Vanderbilt and an associate. And so please roll the John Hay Jock Whitney spot.
As an owner, breeder, and leader of the sport for more than half a century, John Hay Whitney established a legacy as one of the most influential and respected individuals thoroughbred racing has ever known. Born in 1904 in Ellsworth, Maine, Whitney had distinguished bloodlines on both sides of his family. His paternal grandfather, William C. Whitney, was a major figure in political and financial circles and also the family's patriarch in thoroughbred racing. Whitney's mother, Helen, began racing steeplechasers in 1910 under the name of Green Tree Stable. John Hay Whitney, known as Jock, was always passionate about racing. Upon his graduation from Yale, he received two yearlings as a gift from his father and was elected to the Jockey Club at age 24. Whitney campaigned his first American Stakes winners in 1931, running them in the name of his first wife, Mary Elizabeth Altimus. When New York racing was reorganized in 1934, Whitney was appointed to the State Commission. That year, he helped form the American Thoroughbred Breeders Association, the forerunner of the present TOBA.
Whitney served as the organization's president until 1952 and continued as chairman of the board until 1957. Upon his mother's death in 1944, Whitney inherited a controlling interest of Greentree with his sister, Joan Whitney Payson. Greentree remained a major force in American racing and breeding. In the Jock Whitney era, Greentree bred 91 stakes winners, including K-Pod, Horse of the Year in 1949 when he won the Preakness, Belmont, and Pimlico Special. Greentree also bred champions Stage Door Johnny, Late Bloomer, and Bowl Game during this era. The best horse Whitney ever owned was Tom Fool, a private purchase who won all 10 of his races as a four-year-old in 1953 and was named Horse of the Year. Tom Fool's victories in the Metropolitan, Suburban, and Brooklyn secured what was known as the Handicap Triple Crown, which had not been won since Whisk Broom II in 1913. Tom Fool went on to sire more than 30 stakes winners, including Buck Passer, Tim Tam, and Tompion. As well as being a prominent owner and breeder, Whitney served as a steward in the Jockey Club and was prominent in the establishment of the Greater New York Association in 1955. Stage Door Johnny, bred and owned by Greentree, gave Whitney a tremendous source of pride when he won the 100th edition of the Belmont Stakes in 1968. He became the fourth Greentree runner to win the Belmont. Jock Whitney died in 1982 at the age of 77. Whitney was described by racing journalist Kent Hollingsworth as being as close to royalty as American racing ever had.
Now I'd like to request that Peter de Bonaventura, a grandson of Mr. Whitney, come to the podium. I can't help telling you one more thing. When Mr. Vanderbilt a few moments ago was saying that his father used to have some parties and so forth, and among the things my wife and I uncovered was an album of one of those parties, and there's just a lot of guys in tuxedos, but there's one guy with a beard, with a wig, a fake brassiere, and a grass skirt doing the hula. And upon looking closely, that native dancer was Jock Whitney. So anyway, he had a sense of humor too. Okay.
Thank you, National Museum of Racing and Hall of Fame and the Hall of Fame Committee. Gentlemen. First thing I'd like to say is, Alfred, you're a hard man to follow. Good morning, everyone. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here representing my mother, Sarah Wilford, my aunt Kate Whitney, and our family. As you've just seen in this video, Jock, as his friends affectionately called him, and Pop, to the rest of us, had a distinguished racing career spanning some 50 years. Of his many accomplishments in life, captain of the Greentree Polo Team, U.S. Ambassador to the Court of St. James, publisher of the New York Herald Tribune, producer of Selznick International films such as Gone with the Wind, Wuthering Heights, and Rebecca, founder of J.H. Whitney & Company, the first venture capital firm, philanthropist, maybe the most important. But Pop's greatest love, second only to my grandmother, was his beloved Greentree stable. Some years ago, my grandmother, Betsy Whitney, told me a story that would stay with me. Each night as they would sit for dinner, the phone would ring, and John Gaver, Greentree's longtime trainer, was on the other end. She said they would talk for what seemed like hours about upcoming races, promising two-year-olds, yearlings, mares on the farm, etc. My grandpa knew well to hold the first course until after their conversation ended. Pop and Mr. Gaver's relationship was much more than owner-trainer. They were close friends for more than 50 years. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a window into Pop as a person. Loyal friend. Dedicated family man. Generous with his money and his heart. He died some 33 years ago, but oh man, do I feel his presence today, especially here in Saratoga. I think of him nearly every day. Thanks very much.
Now we're going to move on to the next section of today's festivities, that of the historic review inductees. And every endeavor, despite many people's best efforts, every once in a while some names fall through the cracks. And this is what the historic review committee does to make that right. They reach back into, and we've been doing this for about the last 20 years now at the Racing Museum and Hall of Fame. And this year, we're inducting two under that category. And the first is Billy Kelly.
Although he didn't receive the lasting fame of his celebrated stablemate, Sir Barton, Billy Kelly carved out his own impressive legacy in the sport of thoroughbred racing. Billy Kelly made his career debut at the old Kentucky Association track at Lexington in 1918. He won that first start with ease, and then added an allowance victory before stepping up to stakes competition. An eight-length win in the Idle Hour Stakes at Lexington and a four-length victory in the Bashford Manor Stakes at Churchill Downs suggested Billy Kelly was going to be a force to be reckoned with. At Saratoga that summer, Billy Kelly competed five times in a 20-day span, including a track record of 105-3 for 5.5 furlongs in the Flash Stakes. The growing reputation of Billy Kelly prompted Commander J.K.L. Ross to purchase the colt for $27,500. Ross turned Billy Kelly over to trainer H. Guy Bedwell and continued the horse on his summer campaign at Saratoga. 7 days later, Billy Kelly splashed through the mud to win by 8 lengths in the Sanford under 130 pounds to wrap up his Saratoga stretch with 4 wins and a second in 3 weeks. He concluded his remarkable 2-year-old season with a record of 14 wins and 2 seconds from 17 starts. When the calendar turned to 1919, Billy Kelly continued his winning ways with 2 victories before being entered with Sir Barton in the Kentucky Derby. It was expected that Sir Barton was to set a fast pace for Billy Kelly to come running late. However, Sir Barton won by 5 lengths, with Billy Kelly second. While Sir Barton went on to become America's first Triple Crown winner, Billy Kelly also continued to run well. Following the Derby, he won the Toboggan and Capital Handicaps, and also earned victories that year over Sir Barton and Sunbriar, the previous year's Travers winner. Billy Kelly raced 4 more years and won 3 consecutive editions of the Hartford Handicap. He had several other wins over Sir Barton and also defeated former Kentucky Derby winner Old Rosebud. Billy Kelly finished his career with 39 wins and was in the money 60 of his 69 career starts, with earnings of almost $100,000.
So we all know the name of Sir Barton as the first Triple Crown winner. Now you know the story of Billy Kelly, and as the old radio commentator Paul Harvey would say, now you know the rest of the story. Here now to accept this honor is the great-great-grandson of trainer H. Guy Bedwell, Clark Bedwell Schaefer, Jr.
Thank you. A lot of people are saying, who's Billy Kelly and why did it take so long to be in the Hall of Fame? Not quite sure. I guess they just wanted to make sure they made the right pick. My great-grandfather, he's known as the original Triple Crown trainer, and that's what he was famous for. He's also famous, his nickname was Hard Guy, and he lived up to that reputation. Anybody who had ever worked for him or knew him knew that's the way he was. He started out as a cowboy at age 12, riding cattle drives. And then he went from there to having a livery stable. And then in 1907, he became a trainer. And 2 years later, he was the top trainer in the country. So by then, he was a top trainer, top owner for years. Mr. Commander Ross decided to hire him, and they went on to win the Triple Crown before anybody knew who the Triple Crown was. It was 11 years before it happened again. It was another 30 years before anybody acknowledged the Triple Crown. So that's how that became everything. So that's why I'm here. I wasn't around when this happened, but everybody sort of knows me and says, hey, you're the guy I see at the racetrack all the time. So I'm just deeply honored and thankful and appreciate all of this. Thank you.
So, Clark, you might not have been around when all that happened, but don't worry, Ed was. We're now going to induct into the Hall of Fame a jockey who excelled in both of our thoroughbred racing sports, the flat and the steeplechase. Let's take a look at the accomplishments of Vincent Powers.
Born in Westfield, New York in 1892, Vincent Powers enjoyed a fascinating, prosperous, and most unconventional career in the sport of thoroughbred racing. Powers has the unique distinction of being the only jockey to ever lead the North American standings as both a flat and steeplechase competitor. He later added to his eclectic resume when he became the leading steeplechase trainer in North America. Powers won his first race at a recognized track at the age of 15, aboard Brimmer, for a purse of $500 in 1907 at Churchill Downs. The following year, Powers became the leading jockey in America with 324 victories. He again topped the national standings with 173 wins in 1909. Powers won several significant races in 1908, including the Clark Handicap on Polly Prem, the Kentucky Oaks with Elena Dale, and the Latonia Oaks aboard Chulita. He won more prestigious races in 1909, including the Kentucky Derby with Wintergreen. By the end of 1910, Powers was one of America's most accomplished riders, but New York racing was shut down, and Powers relocated to Europe to ride for a guaranteed salary of $10,000. Powers concluded his four-year North American career as a flat jockey with 654 victories. Upon his return to America a few years later, Powers became Greentree Stables' primary steeplechase rider, and in 1917 was the top steeplechase jockey in America with 15 wins. During his time as a steeplechase rider, Powers won the Grand National in 1919 and 1920, and numerous other prestigious events. Powers became the leading steeplechase trainer in America in 1927, saddling 19 winners and setting a record in purse earnings. The great Jolly Roger, a future Hall of Famer, was the big horse in the barn for Powers, earning over $63,000 that year with six victories, including the Grand National. Powers retired from training in 1946. He died October 19, 1966 in New York City at the age of 74.
To accept the Vincent Powers induction plaque is Randall Anderson, the Chautauqua County Sports Hall of Fame. It is a privilege for the Chautauqua Sports Hall of Fame to accept this prestigious honor on behalf of Vincent Powers. The Chautauqua Sports Hall of Fame is dedicated to honoring and preserving the sports history of Chautauqua County, New York. Chautauqua County is located about 7 hours from Saratoga in the extreme southwest corner
of New York State. It was there that Vincent Powers was born 123 years ago in a small village of Westfield on the shores of Lake Erie. Congratulations to the other inductees who have earned this high honor in the sport of horse racing. It is especially fitting that Vincent Powers is inducted in the same year as John Hay Whitney, for Vincent was employed by Greentree as both a jockey and a trainer. Sincere thanks to the Historic Review Committee for selecting Vincent Powers to the National Museum of Racing's Hall of Fame. And I also want to thank Brian Bouillet, Communications Officer of the Hall of Fame, for inviting me to this wonderful ceremony today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Randall, and have a good trip over the next 3 days back to Chautauqua County. And don't worry, by the time you get back there, they still won't have any fracking. Thank you, Governor Cuomo. Up next, let's get a look at some great racing action from a great racehorse. Durable, dependable, game, brave, all summed up in two words, Lava Man.
The story of Lava Man is a rags-to-riches tale of a former claimer that began his career at a county fair and went on to defy the odds and become one of the most successful and popular racehorses in the first decade of the 21st century. Lava Man was bred in California and trained by Lonnie Arterburg until he was claimed during his three-year-old season for $50,000 by trainer Doug O'Neill for STD Racing Stable and partner Jason Wood. Lava Man made his career debut in June 2003 in a maiden claiming race at the San Joaquin County Fair in Stockton, California. He finished fourth at odds of 36-1. Lava Man did not break his maiden until his fifth career start, when he won a maiden special weight at Bay Meadows in his final race as a two-year-old. After being claimed by O'Neill, Lava Man returned to the track for his new owners with a victory in the Fairplex Park Derby trial. Lava Man ran four more times that year, finishing second three times and third once. As a four-year-old, Lava Man began to generate some buzz when he scored his first graded victory in the California Stakes at Hollywood Park.
Lava Man for everything.
He won the first of his three Hollywood Gold Cups in his next start, earning his first Grade 1 victory with the record 8-length win with a 120 Beyer speed figure.
Lava Man is suddenly 4 lengths in front, and forget about it. He is going to open up and run away. Congrats is left in the wake of Lava Man. No way does he catch the winner, and the winner is Lava Man!
Lava Man continued to shine at the age of five by winning the Santa Anita Handicap, defeating Kentucky Derby winner Giacomo and Breeders' Cup Juvenile winner Wilco.
And Lava Man and Corey Nakatani have won the base cap.
He became the first horse since Van Landingham 21 years earlier to win a Grade 1 on both dirt and turf in the same year. Lava Man came back at six to win the Santa Anita Handicap for a second time, and the Hollywood Gold Cup for a third time. He was named California Horse of the Year in 2005 and 2006, California Champion Older Horse in 05, 06, and 07, and California Champion Turf Horse in 2006. Lava Man became a fan favorite, winning seven Grade 1 races, more than any other California bred in history, and compiled a career record of 17 wins, 8 seconds, and 5 thirds from 47 starts, with earnings of more than $5 million. Among California-bred horses, only Hall of Famers Tiz Now and Best Pal and 2014 Horse of the Year California Chrome have higher career earnings.
Lava Man, welcome to Saratoga. Welcome to Saratoga, the owner, co-owner of Lava Man, Steve Kenley.
Wow, this is an honor. It's amazing sitting here, hallowed grounds of Saratoga, you know, the National Race Museum, and we're grateful and honored to be here, the birthplace of the greatest sport we have, horse racing. I want to acknowledge a few people, quite a few people. I'm representing the ownership group, and we have great owners in Jason and Candace Wood, my dad and Tracy Kenley. Team O'Neill's here. Doug couldn't make it. Leandro back home, his foreman. Noe, his groom. Sabas, Tony. You know, we're off in the West Coast. This is the first visit to Saratoga, so this is pretty amazing and eye-opening. You know, our knowledge is the West Coast racing, and the big thing is, you know, Del Mar, Hollywood Park, and no longer, but in Santa Anita. So, you know, other than the Kentucky Derby, you know, the biggest race that I can remember being an influence on me is the Gold Cup. I remember, you know, being my son's age, my father taking me to Hollywood Park. I mean, when you walk in, you have the Great Wall, the marble wall with horses like Seabiscuit, Seattle Slough, Affirmed, Native Diver, Cigar, Citation on this wall, and you were just in awe of, I was in awe of seeing these names and having a horse running that race, let alone win it three times, is surreal. So it's really been an amazing ride with this horse. I also will mention Jason's kids are here. Montana, Reagan, Kendall, my two kids, my little handicapping buddy, Landon, Logan. They love horse racing now. And also, I want to thank Nakatani for putting some amazing rides on Lava Man. Patrick Valenzuela rode him a few times, that record-setting Gold Cup where he won by 8 3/4 length. So, you know, Lava Man, unfortunately, didn't win outside of California. He tried, but just we weren't successful. So, but in California, he was really the king and pretty much unbeatable. When we looked him in the eye, he pretty much won every race down the stretch. So he was a warhorse. He was, I guess, we have a lot of blue blood here today. I guess he was a blue collar in this world of horse racing, kind of what keeps it going in the sense that it just shows you anything's possible. You buy a horse for $17,500, you go in the Triple Crown with Seattle Slough, or you claim a horse like this and end up sitting here today. So that's quite a feat. I mean, he took us around the world. He went to Japan, went to Dubai, New York, Kentucky, Florida. And although we weren't successful, it was always a victory for us because it was an amazing experience that he took us to. And so, you know, hats off to him for bringing us all together as a group. I want to talk about Doug O'Neill. Doug O'Neill is quick to – he's got a great team. He's quick to give a lot of credit to his team, but he's really been a masterful – trainer for this horse, and he just did an outstanding job. He's a real horseman that he doesn't get a lot of credit, but he really is an amazing horseman. The horse had a lot of adversity with his feet. That was Lava Man's big problem. He'd run down to his frog and rub his feet off, so we had to grow a new foot back so many times for him, and he kept bringing him back time after time in grade one races, and he'd show up again. So, you know, he was with us in the hard racing for 4 years and performed miraculously. So, and now he's actually in a second career. He's, you know, Doug's lead pony horse, and, you know, around the barn he's called the Champ. And he accompanied, I'll have another, you know, through the Derby and Preakness here a few years ago. And I think he's a great influence on these young horses. I think they probably feel his presence because he's really an amazing animal. And even today, he gets visitors every week from all over the place. And, you know, he's truly the gift that keeps on giving. Thank you.
So welcome to our fair city, Steve. Had a lot of fun calling a lot of really great horses over the years, and one of the really fun ones I look forward to calling was our next inductee, Extra Heat.
Few sprinters, male or female, have been faster or more successful on the racetrack in the 21st century than champion Extra Heat. In the late spring of 2000, Ken Taylor went to the Timonium Fairgrounds in Maryland to find what his partner and trainer John Salzman Sr. liked to call useful horses. Modestly bred, durable, and above all, affordable. The kind that earn a steady paycheck. Extra Heat seemed to fit the bill. Extra Heat began her career in 2000 with six consecutive victories, including her first graded victory in the Grade II Estorita at Belmont Park.
Extra Heat, a very game filly, and the winner!
After suffering her first career loss in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies that year, Extra Heat bounced back to close out the year with two more stakes wins to cap her season with eight wins in nine starts, including seven stakes. Her brilliance as a two-year-old was merely a glimpse into what Extra Heat's sophomore campaign would bring. She won nine of her 13 starts at three, all in stakes races, including four graded events topped by a record-setting win in the Grade I Prioress at Belmont Park.
Extra Heat, a hard-fought head.
Two of her defeats, in the Breeders' Cup Sprint and the DeFrancis Memorial Dash, were against male competition. Extra Heat acquitted herself well in both, finishing second in the Breeders' Cup and third in the DeFrancis Dash. At the conclusion of the year, she was rewarded for her sensational efforts with the Eclipse Award for Champion Three-Year-Old Filly. Extra Heat continued to thrive at four, winning seven stakes races in 11 starts.
They can't beat the Heat! Extra Heat! She wins it by 2.5.
Five of the victories were in graded events, including the first of back-to-back victories in the Barbara Fritchie Handicap. As a five-year-old, she won her only two starts, capping her illustrious career with a successful defense of her Barbara Fritchie title. That victory moved Extra Heat past 1970s champion and Hall of Famer Susan's Girl for the most added money wins by a filly or mare in modern times. During the course of her four-year career, Extra Heat was worse than third only twice in 35 starts that included 26 wins, 25 of which were in stakes races, a modern distaff record, banking nearly $2.4 million in purse earnings.
The owner of Extra Heat, Ken Taylor.
Good morning. About 13, 14 years ago, my young grandson came up to me and said, "Pop, Pop, how come every time Extra Heat wins a race, Mr. Ken gets up there and he makes a speech and he gets on television and you never get anything?" I said, "Well, I get the money though." But I said, the next time something big comes up, I'm going to make the speech. Ken called me last week, and he said, "Are you going to make a speech?" And I said, "Well, I'm working on one." He said, "There are a lot of speeches, please. Don't do that." I've never said no to Ken. So, I'm going to start with three words that I'm sure most of you love to hear. And in conclusion, I do want to take a minute and thank John, who isn't here with us today, who is our trainer, And Ken, I can never say thanks enough to Ken, who taught me what little bit I learned about horses, but was a great partner. I hope I was as great to him as he was to me. But he took good care of me. And Ken, you're a great guy. I thank you very much. And last but not least, I will thank the ladies and gentlemen who were responsible for making me come today to see a beautiful, beautiful little pony run for the 3 or 4 hours years that we've earned her. And I hope you all have a good time. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the nominating committee for putting her on the ballot. I'd like to thank all the people who voted for her. I'd like to also thank all of the fans, especially the ones in Maryland and New York, for rooting for her victories. I would also like to thank Mr. Durkin for the way he called her races with so much excitement. I'm very happy that my family is here, my wife and some of my grandkids. I also like to thank some of my dear friends that are here, especially Ms. Nancy Salzman that made the trip. That's John Salzman's wife, for you who do not know. John Salzman didn't come today for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is he got 3 horses running tomorrow that me and him own on Saturday. And I was trying to get him to leave them, but he decided he's an old-fashioned trainer and he was not going to leave them. So he's not here, but I just like for everybody to know that John Salzman and myself have been in business for 13 years, and every horse I own, or you see Kenneth Taylor's name, is always John Salzman and Kenneth Taylor. I'd like to thank one other thing, and that's Extra Heat, for getting us all over the world, and like Mr. Durkin said, and that heat is smoking.
Mr. Taylor will be appearing at the Giggles Comedy Club in downtown Saratoga Springs on Thursday night. Hope you can make it. And now to our human inductees into the Hall of Fame today. Chris Antley, I don't know if I ever saw a jockey that had more natural talent than Chris Antley. And that must say something to the man I'm about to introduce right now of the Ellery Training Center. He was the guy that actually taught Chris Antley how to ride. Franklin Smith. Oops. Hold on, Franklin. I need someone to teach me how to follow the run-up show. But before we talk to Franklin, let's look at the video about the great Chris Antley.
Chris Antley grew up in the small South Carolina town of Ellery, which has a population of less than 1,000. It was in Ellery where Antley discovered his calling in life was to ride racehorses. Horseman Franklin Smith put Antley to work at the age of 14 mucking stalls, and Chris worked his way up to exercise rider. He had a special talent of being able to relax even the most unruly of horses. At the age of 17, Antley made his debut as a jockey at Pimlico Racecourse in 1983. He won his first race at the Baltimore track that November aboard Via Condenero. Within a year, he moved his tack to the New York and New Jersey circuits. In 1985, just his third year as a professional, Antley led all North American riders with 469 wins. He won a record 171 races at Monmouth Park that year and led that riding colony in wins again in 86 and 87. Antley won his first 3 Grade 1 races in 1987,
the Monmouth Oaks, Gazelle Handicap, and the Philip H. Island Handicap. That year, he also achieved the spectacular feat of winning a world record 9 races in one day on Halloween, when he had 4 winners in the afternoon at Aqueduct and 5 more that night at the Meadowlands. In 1989, Antley rode at least 1 winner in 64 consecutive racing days. He led the New York circuit that year with 234 wins and won the prestigious Saratoga riding title the following year. Already recognized as one of the top riders in the sport, Antley's reputation as an elite jockey continued to grow in 1991, when, at the age of 23, he won the Kentucky Derby with Strike the Gold. As the 1990s progressed, Antley continued to win major races, including the Hollywood Derby, Santa Anita Handicap, Woodburn, and Jockey Club Gold Cup, among others. In 1999, Antley piloted former claimer Charismatic to victory in the Kentucky Derby and Preakness Stakes. At odds of 31-1, Charismatic was one of the longest shots on the board in the 125th running of the Derby when he defeated Menifee by a head.
Charismatic on the outside takes command. On the inside, Hefty in the middle of the track, Menifee is flying, but it's Charismatic holding on to win it by a head.
Antley and Charismatic again defeated the favored Menifee in the Preakness, which was the final of 127 graded stakes wins for Antley. From 1983 until he died at the age of 34 in 2000, Antley won a total of 3,480 races, including 293 stakes, and had purse earnings of over $92 million.
Welcome to the Hall of Fame, Chris. Here's Franklin Smith.
Thank you all for having us here today. I just want to tell you that never in my life could I have imagined a little blonde-headed 12-year-old boy would ride a bicycle on our farm and just bring us to what we have here today. And we're just all beside ourselves with, you know, enjoyment and so proud of what Chris did in his racing career. And we're just tickled to death to be here today and share this with you. And to say that he was a natural in what he did, as Tom did, he was just that. To say I taught him how to ride, you don't teach someone like him how to ride. It just comes naturally, like all these other Hall of Fame inductees today that are jockeys. And we're just tickled that he's as good, has done the things he's done in riding, and the races that he won, the stakes that he won, and the fact that he set the standard so high and to raise the bar like he did in setting some of the records that he did in winning 9 races in a day and 64 days of at least 1 win a day. It's just an absolute feat that raising the bar like he did to accomplish that has been incredible. And with that, I would like to say that back home in a little town of Ellery, today is Chris Antley Day. And in that, our mayor has declared that Chris Antley Day. We have a little town there of about 700 people, and it's about 4 main roads that lead into town. They come to one little stoplight in town, and right down the street from that stoplight is a little museum that has been developed over the last 25 years that depicts the area and the community and the agricultural past of Ellery and the people around it and the families. And in that museum, which has won a number of awards, I might add, there's a room that's devoted to Chris. And in that room, there's a likeness of Chris. There is pictures and articles about what he did and the derbies he won and the records he set and the accomplishments that he did in racing. And we're just proud of that, and I'll tell you, we're going to take some things back today to add to that. And at the time, I'd like to introduce to you, all of you, his mom and his wife. And if they'd come up, please.
Oh, thank you, baby.
This is Shelley, and this is Natalie.
And I, as a mother, would like to thank everyone here for knowing who he was, what he was about a lot of the time, maybe not all the time, but he believed in each and one of you. And as a mother, all the women out there and the young gentlemen that helped him grow in this sport means the world to us. And I thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah. Shelly just reminded me of a story Chris told me. His grandma used to say, "Chris, you've got to let some of those other boys win sometimes. That's not nice when you win all the races." I just wanted to mention something about polarity. The polarity of soaring achievements on the racetrack. Chris performed feats that may never be achieved again. And just as intensely, his actions and decisions off the track sometimes hit such depths that they became tragic. So the other polarity that I want to mention is the opposite of love and fear. Fear leads us down to a place where we judge, where we're angry, and where we want to separate ourselves. And love allows us to open to a place where we feel joy, and we can find acceptance. So I want to thank you guys for enshrining Chris in the Hall of Fame. It provides a very profound healing opportunity for our family. And you've all shown the power of what happens when we push fear aside and we let love win. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Franklin, Shelley, and Natalie. Up next, one of the most prolific trainers in the history of the game. We were going to loop all together all of King Leatherberry's victories, one race after another after another. That would have been a very, very long videotape. But here's a shorter one, and we hope it can do him justice.
When it comes to winning races, few trainers in the history of thoroughbred racing have done it better than King T. Leatherbury. A legend in his home state of Maryland, the Leatherbury ranked fourth all-time with 6,455 career victories at the time of his 2015 election to the Hall of Fame. Born in Shadyside, Maryland, Leatherbury got his introduction to racing through his father, small-time breeder and owner who took his son to the old Marlboro Racecourse, a 5-furlong track that opened in 1914 in Prince George's County. Once part of the Maryland Fair Circuit, its 3-week meet was ultimately taken over by Bowie Racetrack to the north. Leatherbury attended the University of Maryland and took out his trainer's license in 1958. He won his first race in early 1959 at Florida's Sunshine Park, now known as Tampa Bay Downs, with a horse named Mr. L.
Following the winter of 1960, Leatherbury returned to Maryland to stay and began to build a legacy that is still going strong more than a half century later. Leatherbury's lengthy tenure at the top of the Mid-Atlantic region has included a record 52 training titles in Maryland, 26 apiece at Laurel Park and Pimlico. He also owns 4 training titles at Delaware Park, which served as an extension of the Maryland circuit during Leatherbury's peak years. Starting with Do the Bump in the Grade 3 Allegheny in 1976, Leatherbury has won 154 stakes races, including 23 graded stakes with horses such as Catatonic and Taking Risks, each Grade 1 winners, capturing the 1987 Hempstead Handicap and the 1994 Island Handicap, respectively. At the time of his Hall of Fame election, Leatherbury is one of just 4 North American trainers to top the 6,000 win mark. His horse of a lifetime in a lifetime of horses is the gelding Ben's Cat, a 4-time Maryland Horse of the Year. Leatherbury bred, owns, and has trained him to 29 wins, 24 of them in stakes, through 48 starts with more than $2.4 million in purse earnings.
Ben's Cat on the inside! Ben's Cat! Can Ben's Cat do it? He's remarkable! He's Ben's Cat!
Along with all the wins and accolades, Leatherbury has also ranked among the top 10 nationally in earnings 4 times, amassing more than $63 million in career purse earnings at the time of his Hall of Fame election.
So King Leatherberry's been in the winner's circle a few times, and so too has horse owner Glenn Lane.
Hi, I'm Glenn Lane, lifelong fan and part-time participant in this great sport. I'm very honored and humbled to be here today, and I'm not even the one being honored and inducted. I've known King for over 30 years. We were introduced in 1981 as I expanded my racing operation outside of New York and New Jersey to Maryland. I learned from him back then. I'm still learning from him today. He's taught me about consistency and building scale in any business, but more significantly, he has shown me by example the importance of sharing with friends and family, enjoying life's every minute with humor and humility. And while I may have made some small contribution to his win totals, the experience of working with him and the privilege of calling him my friend far outweigh any statistics. I sent my first horse to Bowie for winter racing shortly after we were introduced. That was where we finally met in person. More on that later. As I think back on my experiences in this amazing business, I have 2 distinct periods. First, as an active owner many years ago, running a diverse operation across the country and working with a variety of different personalities. And second, the more recent, reconnecting with many of my old racing contacts and friends with a little help from social media, 25 years after my last start as an owner. It's this recent time that has been most fulfilling for me as relationships that started in horse racing and based on horse racing have turned out to be lifelong, meaningful friendships. I've had many conversations and reconnections that feel as no time has passed at all, and of course, some new connections. My phone call to King to reconnect a few years back certainly tops the list. I'd never stopped following the game, and I'd been reading about his horse, Ben's Cat, who you saw earlier, and I decided to give him a call. I didn't have a current phone number for him, but no worries. He's still at the same address with the same phone number, and as I found out on the first call with his beautiful wife, Linda, they still have the same old rotary dial phone in that vintage 1960s goldenrod. By the way, although there was a household debate whether to replace the classic goldenrod with a 1990s modern push-button phone, not sure if that happened yet or not. I also got an update on his technology enablement. No email, no computer, no texting, a fax machine that works intermittently. But yes, he does have a cell phone, and that's his preferred communications channel, especially when the broken fax machine is hooked up to the office phone line, which is quite a bit. I made the call to his cell, and our reconnection was instantaneous. As I said earlier, it felt like no time had passed, although it had probably been 25 years since we last spoke. King said, I was just talking about you the other day, about the first day we met. Do you remember? He went on to recall our first meeting in December of 1981 at Bowie. My horse was in the last race of the day, and I decided to make the drive to Maryland from New Jersey. King had made arrangements to stay at the track for the last race, which was definitely not his practice, instead of his usual routine of picking up the boys at school. We spent the day together leading up to the race, and that was the first time I observed him in action on the racing day, running and claiming multiple horses, studying and betting or having an opinion on every race that was being run that day. And that's still his routine to this day, albeit a lower volume of stable activity, but a lot more tracks to follow and to be betting on. The time arrived for us to head to the paddock on the typically cold Bowie winter day. As the horses entered, I noticed that my horse, which I had recently seen at the Meadowlands, looked a little different than I recalled a couple of weeks earlier. And sure enough, it was the wrong horse. King apologized in his typical blunt and self-deprecating style and explained that sometimes it happens. You have two horses come in on the same day. If they're the same color, same sex, it could happen. I'm pretty sure he did take steps to avoid that happening again, but the thing that struck me the most that day and still strikes me today is just his absolute honesty, which is a little different, not always the same in our business we love. Now, many years later, when he recounted the story to me, he added, I knew you and I were going to be okay on that first day when you didn't fire me. For the record, it never occurred to me even for a second. From our first meeting and every interaction following it, it was clear that King was a breed apart. He was and is incredibly structured and disciplined. To this day, he documents everything by hand, whether it's his bills and training records, and especially his betting combinations. We got into a terrific routine of calling at regular times, the morning after training, the evening after dinner. I always look forward to those calls, and then, as today, when we still have them a little less frequently, to discuss our favorite horse. When he trained for me, the discussions with King were different than discussions with my other trainers. We reviewed the horses very quickly and precisely. The feedback was always very factual and objective, never emotional. This was a tremendous lesson for me, which I applied not only to my broader racing operations at the time, but later on in my non-racing activities as well. He may not have gone to the barn as often as the traditional Maryland horseman, but he had developed a trusted team that provided him with solid, consistent observations, and very importantly, was not afraid to deliver bad news, and in turn, he was not afraid to deliver bad news when it occurred. His strong instincts and breadth of experience always enabled him to make the best decision possible based on the feedback. It's unchanged to this day, 56 years and 6,400 wins later. More recently, King has given me and my entire family the great gift of sharing Ben's cats. Great accomplishments. Every rock star has his groupies, and we are beds, with many miles logged to see sub-60-second races all up and down the East Coast. I might add, as a former owner, it's much more fun to share these experiences without having to write checks. And that is my new approach to participation in racing. To this day, King exhibits the same energy, the same consistency, the same enthusiasm, the same humor as always after even 35 years of being friends. I joked with Kate and Bradar in the paddock on Black Eyed Susan Day as she was tweeting out that Ben's cat doesn't know he's 9 as he's walking into the paddock. And I responded, albeit not by tweet, that King doesn't know that he's 82 either. There are so many more great stories and experiences to share about King. You've touched many people along the way. You can hear it in the crowd before and after Ben's every race, win or lose. Daily at home in Maryland, We even saw it last night on the streets of Saratoga as we were walking to dinner and people were coming up to say hello and to congratulate him. And also just reminded me earlier today that King's one win in Saratoga happened to be a jump race with Jerry Fish back aboard many, many years ago. I'm so thrilled and honored to be here as you receive this tremendous and much-deserved recognition from the industry we all love. We love you, King. Come on up.
Thank you, Glenn. You did a good job. However, it was a lot of good stuff he left out. For years now, I have had so many people come up to me and say, racing riders and riders, horsemen, racing officials, fans, all they say, King, you certainly belong in the Hall of Fame. I said, well, thank you very much. But I didn't really get excited about it or anything because I've received so many awards in Maryland. Every racing award there is in the state of Maryland I've received. I've been honored in every ways, even got one honor in Kentucky one time. So I'd have so many awards that I really wasn't going to get excited about this. Now, and then I got nominated. But once I got nominated, I said, well, maybe I had people coming up and say, you're even money to get in there. But I told them I've run many an even money shot. They got beat. But anyhow, they called me up and said, you've been voted in. And I naturally immediately called for a recount on that. So... anyhow, this is truly an honor for me from the Hall of Fame organization and everyone. And it's a very prestigious title. I'm deeply honored with it and proud of it. And it really is a tremendous award. Now, 56 years ago, 1959 it was, won my first race down at Sunshine Park. Now they call it Tampa Bay. And it's a funny story here that 44 years later, after I won that, I got a letter from the president of Tampa Bay. And that was the year I'd won 6,000 wins. I got my 6,000 wins that year, 2003. And all the letter said was, congratulations. Remember, it all started here. So I got thinking, you know, that day I won one, they must have said, listen, we got to keep an eye on this boy. You know, I could see them putting a big chalkboard up there, and every time I win a race, they'd write it down there like that. So anyhow, I appreciate the letter. Now, let me see, the one thing I learned at Sunshine Park, everybody knows Florida has East Coast and a West Coast. And on the East Coast, all old people live. On the West Coast is where their parents live. Now, it's one town right there close to Oldsmar's, where Sunshine Park was. Clearwater is a beautiful town. But it's a one town right close there that nobody dies. Nobody has died for 35 years. Except, no, one, I make a mistake. One person did die. It was the Undertaker. He starved to death. Anyhow, I've gotten old. And I like to tell jokes about old things, because I am an old person, so I get away with telling old things. But I feel good, and one of the things about it, your parts start wearing out a little bit. And I remember 3 years ago, you're reading the forms and everything, and the nines look like fours, and the sixes look like eights. And so I had increased my glasses up to as powerful as they could get. So then I went in, and they said, no, you got cataracts. You got to get those removed. I said, well, what the heck? I'll do it. So I got this cataract surgery, came out, looked in the mirror. I had aged 15 years. Now, I am the third oldest person to be in this honor here. I have Sonny Jim, Carl Hanford. And so I'm proud, I guess, to be the third. It's not the winner, but it's third. Now, but I do feel good, and I think young. I act young. Sometimes it gets me in trouble acting young. You make a fool of yourself sometimes, you know. But I still healthy and feel good. But one thing worried me. When I was home about a week ago, I went down to the family plot at the cemetery where my family's all buried. And I went over to one little spot where I'm supposed to be buried. And what worried me, it was a little sign there that says, coming soon. Now, I was at the track the other day, and my wife called me and said, you know, we had a neighbor that died. She was an elderly lady. And she says, so would you stop on the way home and get a sympathy card? So I stopped. I went in there, and I couldn't find a sympathy card, so I got a late get well card. And you know what I couldn't find was kind of interesting is to find a humorous sympathy card. I couldn't find any. I was thinking maybe that was a good business to get in, you know. No competition at all. You just have. But I don't know about that business being good, but I do have advice for one business. It's McDonald's and especially Wendy's. You know how you order your thing at one window, you pay for it, and you get it at the next window. I suggest have a window in between those windows where you get a chance to bet on whether you get the right order or not. I was going in the track the other day, and somebody yelled at me, Mr. Leatherberry, you give me $10 to get some food? I think this guy probably worked for me maybe 20 years ago or something. I said, wait a minute now. If I give you $10 to get food, how do I know you're not going to bet that money? He said, oh, no, I got my betting money. Now, I knew Chris Antley. I rode him. I knew him. He was a great rider. Extra Heat, saw her run many times. He's a great, great horse. She was a great horse. Now, Lava Man, what they didn't say about Lava Man, they said he was claimed. What they didn't mention is the next year, the guy who he's claimed from committed suicide. This is going on along, last week, I had a very short, I spoke before a group of people and only said two words, not guilty. I guess I have one joke I usually tell, as the guy goes to the doctors. Doctor says, you're in great shape for being 50. He said, who says I'm 50? I'm 60. He said, well, you are in great shape. How old was your dad when he died? He said, who said he's dead? He's 80 years old and doing fine. He said, oh, you are. You got good genes there. Great. How old was your grandfather when he died? He said, who said my granddad's dead? He says he's 102 years old. In fact, he's getting married tomorrow. I said, my gosh. He said, hey, why? But tell me something. Why would a man 102 years old want to get married? He said, who says he wants to? I got one more. That my son said wouldn't work. But I do it anyhow because I don't listen to them very much. It's three elderly women. See, once again, I can tell old jokes. I'm one of them. So three old ladies, elderly ladies, were talking, and one said, you know something, I'm sometimes standing at the bottom of the stairs, and I'm saying to myself, now, did I just come down, or am I wanting to go up? And she said, the other lady says, you know, I have the same thing. I'll have the refrigerator door open. And I'm saying, now, did I just put something in, or am I going to try to get something out? The third lady says, thank goodness I don't have that problem. Excuse me while I get the door. That's all I got.
Now you know why we put King Leatherberry last, because nobody's going to follow that act, folks, I got to tell you. Want to thank the sponsors that make this all possible, FTI Consulting. Oh, by the way, can we have all of the King and all the other inductees, could you please come up now? And Barbara, I'm going to put you in charge of this. We'll have them all lined up right here, is that correct? Barbara Livingston? Up on the stage, please. Yes. So we could have our inductees please come up on the stage. We have to get a photo of the group ensemble here. Up here, please. Yeah, right up here, King, if you could. Up here. The photographer's going to take a group of everybody. Yeah. So, again, I'd like to thank the sponsors, FTI Consulting, Maserati of Albany, Saratoga Springwater, Jackson Family Wines, the New York Racing Association, the Stronach Group, and Druthers Brewing. And a special thanks to Fasig Tipton and Keeneland Broadcast Services. And a special thanks to you all. It was a great, great morning, and you helped make that happen. Thank you all.
Well, there you have it. The 2015 Hall of Fame inductions are in the books, and four new members elected to the Hall of Fame, and JT couldn't think of a better way to end it than with King Leatherberry, and always a delight to hear from him, and loves to tell a joke or two, doesn't he?
One of the best stand-up comedians I've seen in a long time. His material is as old as he is, but it's well-delivered. He has a lot of practice with it, and it was very entertaining.
Mike Penna, Jude Feld, our producer Michelle Penna. We are positioned at the Racing Hall of Fame, the Fasig Tipton Sales Pavilion. And, Jude, let's recap what we saw. And, by the way, just so people are aware, we mentioned earlier in the pre-show that we are expecting to be joined by the newest trainer elected to the Hall of Fame, King Leatherberry, coming up in just a little bit. So stay tuned for that as we wrap up this broadcast here for the next 20 to 30 minutes. The evening, or the morning, I should say, began with a really nice acceptance speech by A.G. Vanderbilt III on behalf of his father, who was passed away in 1999 but was elected by the committee here as one of the pillars of racing. And great way to begin the program here today.
Yeah, no question about it. Alfred Wynn Vanderbilt was just an awesome man. He was so good for the sport. They talked about his early career when he was purchasing racetracks in his 20s and his development of Sagamore Farm you know, just tremendous history there, and a man that loved our game, went to the racetrack daily, actually went to watch his horses breeze the morning that he died. An amazing human being, and a guy that I had the pleasure of meeting at Santa Anita a long, long time ago when he was campaigning some horses there during the winter. Just a man who loved our sport, every aspect of it, and cared deeply about it, wanted to see it prosper and do well at all times, and sometimes was critical of what was going on, but did everything in his power to make it better.
He was joined in that category by John Hay Whitney, and that is how the morning began. And then we segue into the two members that were elected by virtue of the Historic Review Committee. And as Tom Durkin, the MC, mentioned, they go back for about the past 20 years. They've gone back and looked at members who maybe had slipped through the cracks here and there. And Billy Kelly, not an individual, but a horse who had won 39 races, including 14 as a juvenile back in 1918, made five starts in 20 days here at Saratoga. You talk about old school. Billy Kelly was as old school as they come.
Well, you know, I always harp on that fact, the people that think horses need, like, you know, 6 months off between starts. I'm a little old school myself. I'm not as old as Leatherberry, but I'm a lot closer to his age than there are some of the people that think, you know, horses need long rest. But what one thing I took away from the Billy Kelly induction was 14 wins as a two-year-old. If somebody ran a two-year-old 14 times, you know, nowadays, they would say, oh, that trainer's a butcher.
Yeah, they'd be in jail. Right.
Yeah.
Right, they'd be out of the sport altogether.
Right. And it's like, you know, an amazing feat and a fantastic horse. And so glad after hearing about Billy Kelly today, a horse that I didn't know anything about, and I know a lot of racing history. You know, it was a great induction and a very wise move to put that horse into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, second to Sir Barton in the Kentucky Derby before Sir Barton went on to win the Triple Crown and become the first Triple Crown winner in our sport. Billy Kelly was joined by Vincent Powers, the champion flat and steeplechase jockey, champion steeplechase trainer, and Kentucky Derby winning jockey. And I thought that was very fitting as well. You don't often, at least in this modern era, you don't see jockeys competing in both the flats and the steeplechase, and then to go on and what he did as a trainer is simply remarkable.
Well, you don't see too many flat jockeys that A, can ride a steeplechase horse, and you don't see too many steeplechase horse jockeys that are light enough to ride on the flat. So it is a tremendous feat. He was born 123 years ago, so not any relatives around to accept.
A couple years before you.
Yeah, just a little bit. Remember that guy that asked me if I saw Man of War run? I've never forgiven him for that, but he didn't know. But anyway, a very worthy recipient as well. Obviously, someone that was at the top of their game when they were racing. You know, probably in the vicinity of 110 years ago.
Yeah. Well, then we moved into the contemporary portion of the evening, and that was really what everybody turned out to see. Lava Man, Extra Heat, both being elected in terms of horses, and then Chris Antley, followed by King Leatherberry at the end of the program here. And there was no shortage of humor in this year's speeches, including the duo that got up there to accept for Extra Heat, Ken Taylor and the other co-owner of Extra Heat as well.
Yeah, well, they got up there, and the one owner had a list that looked like one of those old computer printouts that they used to have with the little holes on either side. He pulled out this sheet that was about 27 pages long, and everybody's thinking, oh, no, I hope he's not going to start there. But it was all in good fun, and I'll tell you what, Durkin was laughing a lot up there. He seemed to really enjoy himself, and it was a great acceptance speech. The owner wearing his Extra Heat hat with the red, white, and blue American flag bill, and he really did a good job.
And I really enjoyed the acceptance speech made on behalf of jockey Chris Antley, who, as we mentioned earlier, left us far too soon when he passed away very early in his early 30s. And he was presented by Franklin Smith, who, as you heard Tom Durkin reference, the man who is credited with teaching Chris Antley how to ride, although he disputed that fact in his speech. He said nobody teaches these Hall of Fame riders how to ride. They're just born to do it. And I love the fact that he mentioned that Ellery, South Carolina, where Chris Antley was raised, is, for today anyways, known as Chris Antley Day. And I think that that's pretty cool in Ellery.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Ellery, a town of 700 people. And he mentioned that they have a museum there, an Ellery Museum, and there's a whole room dedicated to Chris Antley, and that they were going to take some memorabilia home today from the Hall of Fame induction to put in that room in the museum in Ellery. So very, very touching acceptance speech, too, by Chris's mom and his wife. And it was a very poignant moment here at the Hall of Fame induction.
Yeah, his mom, Shelley, his wife, Natalie, as they were taking pictures with the plaque, as they did for each of the Hall of Fame inductees here today, the entire pavilion just rose in unison for that standing ovation. And it was a bit of an emotional moment, but very good to see, as Chris Antley is now enshrined forevermore in racing's Hall of Fame. And then, of course, it brought us to the, well, the feature act of the evening, if you will look at it like that. And that was now Hall of Famer King Leatherberry, and he told me a couple of months ago when he joined me on our Trainer Talk program, right after it was announced that he was going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, that the one thing he was most excited about was coming here to Saratoga, because he doesn't get to come here very often, and people here in Saratoga have never heard his material, so he couldn't wait to get up here and do it.
Well, I think that was true, because the place was rolling. He had everybody eating out of the palm of his hand. It was a good probably 15 minutes of material that he did, and well thought out, well delivered, and never said a word about horses or racing.
Very little.
Very little. I'm wondering if we have him on, if we're going to get more jokes, or we're actually going to talk about a horse.
Well, that is King Leatherberry, and I can remember when we were at the Preakness this year, and Ben's Cat was running, and he was on one of the undercard, it might even been on Black Eyed Susan Day, the day before. But what they did is they arranged for King Leatherberry to come in with the Budweiser Clydesdales. And he was riding on the wagon, and they billed it as the King of Beers meets the King of Maryland Racing. And today, he is the King in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that's the first time that King Leatherberry's ever been on the wagon. But I'm pumped.
No stranger.
See, he's not the only one.
You think he'll be celebrating tonight?
Yeah.
Or this afternoon?
I think it's probably going to start as soon as he gets off the air with us.
I want to know where he's going. I can't get enough of that material.
Yeah.
I want to hear more from the King.
Well, he's a fantastic guy, and hopefully he works his way up here. It looks like maybe they're bringing him up right now, huh?
Yeah, they are attempting to bring him here.
But they're shaking hands and kissing babies.
Yeah, hordes of media and fans and everybody trying to just get a glimpse of the King. We're going to step away for a quick minute and a half break. We're back and hopefully be joined by King Leatherberry. It's next on your coverage of the Hall of Fame inductions, all presented by the Maryland Horse Breeders Association.
Celebrating 10 years of Eclipse award-winning coverage. Thank you for making HRRN your home for a decade of memories.
Every morning in Maryland, a new day dawns on more than 16,000 horse farms. From the mountains to the ocean and all along the Chesapeake Bay, new life surges from paddock to field to track, energizing the O-line state's grandest sport. Maryland, we grow horses.
To learn more about racing and breeding in Maryland, visit MarylandThoroughbred.com.
HRRN's Saturdays at Saratoga series continues tomorrow with the Whitney and the Test Stakes. Tune in beginning at 5 p.m. Eastern for live stakes racing from the Spa.
And it's Moreno. Moreno to win the Whitney in a wire-to-wire score.
Saturdays at Saratoga. Every Saturday this summer. Only on HRRN. Go to horseracingradio.net for a complete schedule or to listen live. The Arlington Million.
Little Mike close to the finish. Osiris closing, but time's up. Little Mike made every yard a winning one. And the Apache found just a bit more than Real Solution. Close to the finish, and it's hard to score, edging clear at the 11-1. Hard to score has won.
The Arlington Million. Saturday, August 15th. Beginning at 4:30 Eastern. Go to horseracingradio.net for more information or to listen live.
Hello, this is Bill Mott. You're listening to Horse Racing Radio Network.
Back to the Fasig Tipton Sales Pavilion in Saratoga Springs, New York. Mike Penna, Jude Feld taking you through this 2015 edition of the Hall of Fame inductions, and what a day it has been. All capped off by the 82-year-old newest training member of the Hall of Fame. That is King Leatherberry, the native of Baltimore, who has saddled to date 6,457 winners. That career still going strong. Of course, it began, as you heard, in 1959 at Sunshine Park, now known as Tampa Bay Downs, and it is truly an honor to welcome Hall of Famer King Leatherberry to the program here with us today. King, congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's my privilege.
Yeah, happy to have you on board, and you and I have talked on several occasions, and you've told me the one thing you were looking forward to most about coming up here is that the folks in Saratoga had never heard your material.
They had virgin ears.
Well, you did a great job, I'll tell you. That was the best stand-up I'd seen in a long time. I was very impressed with that. And not one word about horses.
Hey, King, how do you put this into words, what this means to you, your life, your career?
Well, this is the ultimate award, and so, you know, it just came at a good time. My stable has diminished. I only bet 14 horses now. And so a trainer can only be a trainer as long as you have owners supplying him with horses. And I'm my own supplier, but the horses are generally cost you money. So it's a matter of how much they bring in as opposed to how much it costs to keep them.
Do you welcome other owners,
or
do you like doing your own thing?
No, yeah. I welcome, yeah. Over the past, I've had many, many owners. At one time, I had a few. I can't even count them, what I had a year I was leading trainer of the country. But then when you get old, see, generally, your owners are older than you are. So naturally, they're going to leave you. They get old and die. I mean, that's what people do. So I lost a lot of them. And Mr. Marriott, he used to train for one of the Marriotts. And he would breed really good horses in Kentucky and sell some, and the others he'd give me to train. So it was like every year I had 10 horses and fresh horses coming in. And when he died, that cut that off. So then some of my training, claiming owners, a couple of those died about the same time, and then one went out of business because his business had gone bad on him. So basically it left me with nobody to supply me with horses except myself. So, and that's fine as long as you got a horse like Ben's Cat financing it. And that's what he's done for the last couple of years, is finance the operation.
Yeah, he carries the ball. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you claim horses for yourself as well?
Yeah, I do. When I see something that I just can't let get by, I try to talk somebody else into it. And that is what you have to do. It was funny. It's a funny story because I had this claiming stable called Quality Hill Stable. And we did great. We won races and races, races for many years. They finally went out of business. And then about 5 years after that, I was up at Delaware Park having lunch, and my son was with me, and he and the guy came by, and he said, "I said, sit down here and have a something to eat with us." He said, "Well, no," but he started telling my son. He said, "You know, son, I'm gonna tell you something about your dad." He said, "You know." He would call me, meaning I would call him, and he said, to claim a horse. And he said, the stories alone were worth the money that the horse cost. But you have to, you know, in order to talk somebody into buying a horse, you have to tell them why. Why do you think this horse is going to be better? He's going to want to go long. He needs blinkers. You got to come up with something to stimulate this guy to dig in these pockets to bring it about $10,000.
Well, you're a legendary handicapper. I mean, everybody knows it. Yeah. And you like to bet, which is a great thing for a claiming trainer because it keeps you sharp looking at the races, watching the horses.
And knowing the categories that you want to try to get a horse for.
Do you have any specific things you like to look for, like horses bred to run on the turf?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Now that's I love the turf. That's why I'd rather bet turf racing than anything. But and then I like to see when you're claiming something, you're getting for what's coming up in the next 2 or 3 months. You want that horse to continue to improve, and that's what you're trying to find is an improving horse.
Right.
But when you're betting, it doesn't matter about 2 months from now. It's what you think that horse is going to do today. That's when you want him to run the big race, when you're betting on him. But so it all ties in together.
And sometimes they merge.
Yeah.
Sometimes you find that horse going up. It's a nice price or whatever, and you can claim him and keep him going. Yeah.
Now, that's what you look for.
King, when you think back on this career that has now ended here in the Hall of Fame, not ending, it's still ongoing, but more than 6,400 wins, what are a couple of the moments that always are going to stand out to you that you're never going to forget?
Well, this, of course, it's hard to compare horses because horses in different categories, different kind of thing. You'll have a horse like Port Conway Lane that won 52 races. He wasn't the best on me. He won a couple stakes and cheaper stakes. Then you have this really fast horse like Taking Risk. I had the one that didn't last long. He went bad. And then you have Ben's Cat that is not only good, but he lasts and lasts. So it's hard to compare horses because some of them are good at some things and some of them are extremely fast but unsound.
Joe Clancy joined us in the pre-show before the ceremony tonight, and he actually made the point that you have won one race here in Saratoga, but it was with a jump race, right?
Yeah, I tell that story. And what it was, I was at Delaware Park, and the racing secretary here at Saratoga was trying to fill this steeplechase race. He had 5 horses. So he searched around. He said, hey, that guy Leatherbury down in Delaware had claimed a horse. He probably doesn't even know he can jump. So he called the racing secretary at Delaware. The guy called me over and said, hey, you know, you're trying to fill this race. You got a jumping horse. I said, well, okay, good. So I said, go ahead and we'll enter him in the race, suck him on a van, send him up here, boom, he wins it.
That's classic.
It should all be that easy.
Fantastic. Well, you've always found great spots for your horses. That was one of the keys to your success.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Because you know the class and the
It's just like managing a prize fighter. You know, you want to match him with somebody he can beat. You don't want to get him knocked out.
Right. So the horses, they didn't let grass grow under their feet. If they didn't run good, then they were in the right spot the next time.
No, that's true. But what you have to is the economics of the game. You know, the bills keep piling up, and the horses get, and that's what he was bred for. That's what he was bred for, is to run. And so he has to try to pay his way the best he can.
And that was one of the other things, is you kept your owners in business for a long time.
Yeah.
You had people that you trained for many years on end because you were able to do that and keep the cash flow going.
It's a funny thing that I don't know the kid's name, but it was some student down in University of Kentucky, Louisville. It was here in Louisville, Kentucky. And he had done a thing on me. That was his project. And from an owner's standpoint, how much it cost and how much a horse brought in. And he did it for a whole year, and he showed where my horses were making money for the owner, and which is hard to do.
Very rare.
Yeah.
No, that's great.
Visiting with racing's newest Hall of Fame trainer, King Leatherberry, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. King, you were presented by longtime owner Glenn Lane today.
Right.
Why Glenn?
Oh, well, now Glenn is, he started the business, he's only like 20 years old when he started, and he had built up to where he had like over 100 horses in training, and a remarkable guy, and he was helping me at the time. He'd call me up, and because he's a computer man, and I'm not. So he could use a computer and say, here's Ben's Cat's got a race in Kentucky and Canada and all these things. So it was an aid to me. And plus, he's a friend. He's a really extremely nice guy. And he told the story, which I wanted to tell, about bringing the wrong horse over. Here I'm standing at Bowie in December in an outside paddock. First met this guy. Never seen him before. He walks in there and he introduced myself. Okay, I'm going to run this horse for him. And we're sitting there waiting. Here comes the wrong horse in the paddock. Mm-hmm. And like I say, normal person would say, Mr. Leatherbury, glad to meet you, but that's it. I want to try to find somebody else.
Well, he stuck with you, and he stuck with you all the way to the Hall of Fame.
Yeah,
here today.
He did. That's right.
Yeah, remarkable story and a remarkable career, and I know it's still ongoing. And, King, can't thank you enough for spending a little time here with us today. You're always very, very gracious with your time, and congratulations on the Hall of Fame.
My pleasure being here, and thank you very much.
Yeah, King Leatherberry here on the Horse Racing Radio Network and racing's newest Hall of Fame trainer. We're going to step away for one final break. We'll come back and wrap it up live from Saratoga Springs. All of this coverage presented by the Maryland Horse Breeders Association.
This is HRRN, your exclusive home for the Breeders' Cup World Championships.
Every morning in Maryland, a new day dawns on more than 16,000 horse farms. From the mountains to the ocean and all along the Chesapeake Bay, new life surges from paddock to field to track, energizing the O-line state's grandest sport. Maryland, we grow horses.
To learn more about racing and breeding in Maryland, visit MarylandThoroughbred.com. Jude Feld, the pontiff of the Pick Four. You hear him on HRRN Radio. Now get his personal selections directly from him at his new site, PopeJude.com. Every analysis sheet at PopeJude.com has his personal selections and insights. Each page is a handicapping lesson packed with years of racing knowledge, coupled with insider information gleaned from the pontiff's countless connections in thoroughbred racing. Whether you're looking for another set of eyes on the past performances or inspired racing analysis to assault the windows, PopeJude.com is the site for you.
HRRN's Saturdays at Saratoga series continues tomorrow with the Whitney and the Test Stakes. Tune in beginning at 5 p.m. Eastern for live stakes racing from the Spa.
And it's Moreno! Moreno to win the Whitney in a wire-to-wire score!
Saturdays at Saratoga. Every Saturday this summer, only on HRRN. Go to horseracingradio.net for a complete schedule or to listen live. The Arlington Million.
Little Mike close to the finish. Osiris closing, but time's up. Little Mike made every yard a winning one. And the Apache found just a bit more than Real Solution. Close to the finish, and it's hard to score. Edging clear at the 11-1. Hard to score has won.
The Arlington Million. Saturday, August 15th. Beginning at 4:30 Eastern. Go to horseracingradio.net for more information or to listen live.
This is Bob Baffert, and you're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Mike Pena, Jude Feld, back with you in Saratoga Springs, New York, just wrapping up a very special day at these Hall of Fame inductions. And Jude, really need to thank a few people for all their help here today, including Brian Boyer with the Racing Hall of Fame. He has been a huge supporter of what we do on the network all year long, and really appreciate all Brian's help in getting us set up here today. Of course, our man Isaac, who handles all of our technical needs here at the Hall of Fame, and the folks at the Maryland Horse Breeders Association for their sponsorship and their support of not just this program here today, but everything they do throughout the year. Cricket Goodall, they just do a remarkable job with Maryland Racing. And today was a very special day for Maryland Racing with, of course, King Leatherberry and the outstanding filly and mare, Extra Heat, who had so much success in the state of Maryland.
Yeah, no, it was a Maryland tribute day today. And fantastic for all those connections and the great horse, the great trainer. And everybody, I think, in racing, very pleased that King Leatherberry made it into the Hall of Fame and was here to enjoy it. And we certainly did.
Yeah, we certainly did. And we're back tomorrow morning as we kick off well, a really busy Saturday here on the network. You can join us from 8 to 10 Eastern. SiriusXM Channel 92 is your home for the Equine Forum. We'll host that program just across the street at Saratoga and be joined, among others, by Hall of Famer Pat Day as he talks about winning 5 Whitney Stakes. And, boy, it should be a lot of fun to visit with him. Among his winners are Java Gold and Awesome Again and How About Easy Goer. So we'll have a little time to visit with him, maybe even Hall of Famer Shug McGahee, who saddled a couple of winners in the Whitney. He won it with Personal Ensign, came back the following year with Easy Goer. So we'll talk to him. He has Honor Code going in the Whitney. We come back Saturday afternoon, 5 to 6, with all of that coverage of the Whitney and the test. So tomorrow, a very busy day, and we'll encourage folks to tune in.
Yeah, it's a fantastic card here at Saratoga tomorrow. Really looking forward to it. So you don't want to miss the show. It'll be always a fun show in the mornings at Saratoga. We're out there on the apron and a lot of people walking by. We get a little surprise guest once in a while. We'll see some dignitary, some special person that we can snag. And they're usually pretty good about coming and joining us.
So. We will use Sunday as a day of rest, and we'll come back on Monday and Tuesday evening with our exclusive coverage of the Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale, which is all presented by our friends at Embrace the Race, the apparel for the horse racing lifestyle. You want to join us each evening, Monday and Tuesday, 7 o'clock Eastern time. All of this coverage streaming live on our website. And, of course, Monday and Tuesday night, you can also tune in throughout North America on Sirius 93. So a lot of ways to tune in and listen to us. We will also encourage you to go to our website and to check out our trainer talk show with King Leatherbury. It's a two-part program. The first half was recorded, Jude, with you and I back in July of 2013. The second half I recorded with King back in May of this year after he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, or it was announced that he would be inducted. So you won't want to miss it. You can go back, click on the show tab at the top, go to Trainer Talk, and you'll find Trainer Talk with King Leatherbury as you scroll down. And trust me, it's an absolute delight to talk with him and to hear his entire story. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, no, he's a very cool guy, and it was really a lot of fun to visit with him after this show. So you don't want to miss those. Those are very, very good trainer talks.
All of that is on our website at horseracingradio.net. You can follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. And, brother, that's a wrap for the 2015 Hall of Fame inductions.
Yeah.
That's so enjoyable.
Can't wait till next year.
Already.
I think it's one of the most fun things we do. I really enjoy it. And, you know, it's such a great game. You see everybody here that really appreciates the hard work that people have put into our sport, past and present.
I'm going to give you a winner right now, 1 year out. Victor Espinoza. Bet on it. Take it to the fire. You got a house, bet it. You got two houses, bet them both. He gets in next year.
Wipe the chalk off your face.
1-9. All right. Well, from Saratoga Springs, I want to thank Lee Delapina, our producer, back in Lexington, Kentucky. My beautiful wife, Michelle, for taking care of us here on site. And for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time, tomorrow morning, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.